You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Good morning, this is Jeff Blankfort with the April 23rd, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way on KZOX and Z, the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Next week happens to be one of those fifth Wednesdays, and so tune in then and have the opportunity then to share your takes on the world with your fellow listeners. And now on with the show. I expect that most of you, like many of your fellow Americans, breathe a sigh of relief on hearing that Steve Bannon would no longer be around to advise President Trump at the White House. That was supposed to be the week's good news. The bad news is that he wasn't shown the door because of his nationalist white supremacist sentiments, but because of a statement he made objecting to any use of force to resolve Washington's conflict with North Korea, and what was completely unheard of, his support for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from South Korea as part of a deal to defuse the current crisis between the two countries. In a phone interview with a liberal American Prospect magazine, one that he himself had initiated, Bannon, responding to a question about North Korea, told the journal's founder and co-editor Robert Kuttner that there's no military solution here. They got us. Until somebody solves the part of the equation that shows me that 10 million people in Seoul don't die in the first 30 minutes from conventional weapons, said Bannon, I don't know what you're talking about. On the day Bannon's comments were reported in the New York Times, an accompanying article cited reports that Trump was considering firing the man who is his national strategy advisor and a key player in his victory last November. Analysts in East Asia were incredulous that Bannon would suggest pulling all U.S. troops out of South Korea, said the Times, citing David Straub, a former U.S. diplomat and currently a fellow with the Sejong Institute in Seoul. The idea, he said, that anyone in the White House would even consider withdrawing U.S. forces defending South Korea if North Korea would only agree to a verifiable freeze of its current arsenal of an estimated 60 nuclear warheads is stunning, said Straub. It would be preemptive surrender to a regime whose ultimate aim is to unify the Korean Peninsula under its own terms, end quote. But there were even more important critics of Bannon, the four generals to whom President Trump has surrendered control of the country's armed forces, his new chief of staff, John Kelly, his war secretary, James Mad Dog Mattis, his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, whom Bannon had been trying hard to oust, and head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joseph Dunford. At the time that Bannon's remarks became public, Dunford was in Beijing meeting with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, and Mattis and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson were conferring in Washington with Japan's foreign and defense ministers. Tillerson, while acknowledging that he had read Bannon's comments, chose simply to say that Washington's diplomatic campaign must be backed up by the threat of, quote, strong military consequence if North Korea chooses wrongly, unquote. Another round of U.S. joint military exercises with South Korea, the second this year and scheduled to last 11 days, began on Monday, ostensibly aimed to prevent an attack by the North on the South. The likelihood that North Korea would invade the South is as close to non-existent as anything could be, but it didn't stop yesterday's New York Times reporting it as a fact. The possibility of a renewed conflict initiated by Washington and the long-neglected history of the wholesale destruction of that country by U.S. forces is the focus of today's program. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Christine Ahn from the Korea Policy Institute about the likely impact on North Korea of the recently approved U.N. sanctions, the latest developments in the war of words between Washington and Pyongyang, and what implications President Trump's bellicose speech on Afghanistan Monday night might have for both Koreas. So stay tuned for that. Korea is called a forgotten war, notes John DeLury, a professor in the International Relations Department at Yonsei University in Seoul. And part of what has been forgotten is the utter ruin and devastation that we rained down on the North Korean people. This has been ingrained into the North Korean psyche, he adds, which is not surprising. How bad was it? Close to President Trump's threat to hit the country with, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen. You remember General Curtis LeMay, who became infamous for promising to bomb Vietnam back into the Stone Age? Well, he also played a role in North Korea's destruction. "We went over there," LeMay said, "and fought the war and eventually burned down every town in North Korea anyway, somewhere or another. Over a period of 3 years or so, we killed off, 20% of the population. We burned down just about every city in North and South Korea," both LeMay wrote. "We killed off over 1 million civilian Koreans," end quote. Donald Boat, a chemical officer for the U.S. 8th Army, was quoted as saying that on an average good day, our pilots, quote, dropped 70,000 gallons of napalm, 45,000 from the U.S. Air Force, 10,000 to 20,000 by the Navy, and 4,000 to 5,000 by the Marines, who nicknamed the burning jellied gasoline cooking oil. In his 2013 book, Napalm, author Robert Neer noted that a total of 32,357 tons of napalm were used on Korea, about double that dropped on Japan in 1945. Moreover, more bombs were dropped on Korea than in the whole of the Pacific theater during World War II, 635,000 tons as opposed to 503,000 tons. According to Robert Neer, Pyongyang, a city of 500,000 people before 1950, was said to have only two buildings left intact. "This is still living memory in North Korea," he wrote, as was the sadism on the part of those conducting that war from Washington. "If we keep on tearing the place apart, we can make it the most unpopular affair for the North Koreans," Defense Secretary Robert Lovett said after the napalm and aerial bombing campaigns of 1950 and 1951. That's according to Bruce Cummings, a University of Chicago professor who's written several books on North Korea. "We ought to go right ahead," Lovett reportedly said. Dean Rusk, who would go on to become Secretary of State, recalled that the U.S. bombed, quote, "everything that moved in North Korea, every brick standing on top of another," end quote. After running low on urban targets in the latter stages of the war, U.S. bombers destroyed hydroelectric and irrigation dams, flooding farmland and destroying crops. That was according to former Washington Post correspondent Blaine Hardin. It finally came to a point where Air Force commanders complained that they'd run out of targets. Charles K. Armstrong, a professor of Korean history at Columbia, would write that, quote, "the physical destruction and loss in life of both sides was almost beyond comprehension, but the North suffered the greater damage due to American saturation bombing and the scorched earth policy of the retreating U.N. forces." Then there's a testimony of General Douglas MacArthur, the storied general from the Pacific Theater in World War II, who publicly butted heads with President Harry Truman over how the war in Korea was being conducted and ended up being relieved of his command on April 11, 1951. MacArthur had wanted to take the war across the Yalu River into China after its troops had entered the war on North Korea's behalf, and Truman, intent on keeping the war confined to the Korean Peninsula, fired him. The general subsequently testified at joint hearings before the Senate's Committee on Armed Services and Committee on Foreign Relations about his dismissal, but what he had to say about the conduct of the war has been largely excluded from history books. Here's what he said. I shrink with a horror that I cannot express in words at this continuous slaughter of men in Korea," he told the members of Congress. "The war in Korea has already almost destroyed that nation of 20 million people." And he said that at a time when the war was not yet even a year old. "I have never seen such devastation," he went on. "I have seen, I guess, as much blood and disaster as any living man, and just curdled my stomach the last time I was there. After I looked at the wreckage and those thousands of women and children and everything, I vomited. If you go on indefinitely, you are perpetuating a slaughter such as I have never heard of in the history of mankind," end quote. The United States has never been able to truly come to terms with that havoc it wrote during that conflict, so it has chosen to forget it, an option that was never open to North Korea. "Americans know the Korean War is a forgotten war," wrote Bruce Cummings, which is another way of saying that generally they do not know it. "A war that killed upwards of 4 million people, 35,000 of them Americans," he notes, "is remembered mainly as an odd conflict sandwiched between the good war, World War II, and the bad war, Vietnam," end quote. nor did Washington ever consider paying reparations for the death and destruction its intervention had caused the Koreans, nor is the legality of that intervention questioned. The same would be true of our war in Vietnam that began a decade later and extended to Laos. None of those countries had ever attacked or threatened us until the recent statement by North Korean Premier Kim Jong-un following the latest round of U.N. sanctions on Pyongyang pushed by Washington. The American mindset was reflected in a recent article in the New York Times examining how Trump's predecessors had dealt with North Korea. In 1993, the Times' Russell Goldman wrote on August 17th that the North launched a missile capable of hitting Japan. Former President Jimmy Carter went to negotiate with Kim Il-sung, the North Korean leader, against the wishes of President Bill Clinton. The deal that Carter struck and Clinton would eventually agree to after Kim's death amounted to what Goldman described as a generous offer. Clinton promised to lift all sanctions, decades old, supply the North with 500,000 tons of oil a year, and provide $4 billion in aid to construct a light water reactor capable of producing nuclear energy but not weapons. In exchange for the reactor and oil, the North would end its weapons program and close but not dismantle its nuclear complex. As a result of the Republican sweeping Congress of the 1994 midterm elections, however, the oil shipments were often delayed, the sanctions remained in place, and the light water reactors never built. By 1998, according to the Times, the North had secretly restarted its weapons program with technology purchased from the Pakistani scientist A.Q. Khan, and by 2003, the agreement was completely abandoned. The lesson was an important one for North Korea, wrote the Times, Goldman. By provoking the West, the government had profited. It received several years of free oil and kept its nuclear power plant intact. The United States spent millions in aid and only briefly delayed the North weapons program, end quote. That this was hardly compensation for what the U.S. had done to North Korea a half century earlier obviously did not occur to Goldman, nor I suspect to the Times editors or readers. It's well to recall that serious questions remain about which side initiated the war in 1950. Listeners to my March 22nd program heard me quote from a pamphlet entitled Korea, The Lie That Led to War by Sir John Pratt, who worked for the British Foreign Service for 13 years, was an advisor on Far Eastern Affairs in the Foreign Office, and served for 2 years as head of the Far Eastern section of Britain's Ministry of Information. If you didn't hear it the first time, and since you are not likely to hear it anywhere else, it bears repeating. At dawn on Sunday, June 25, 1950, wrote Pratt, South Korean President Syngman Rhee launched a sudden attack which took the North Koreans by surprise. His forces crossed the 38th parallel at several places and captured Haiju, some miles to the north on the road to Pyongyang. The North Koreans staged a counteroffensive, and the South Koreans threw down their arms and fled. The North Koreans then drove on across the parallel and staged a full-scale invasion of South Korea. For nearly a year, wrote Pratt, both North and South Koreans had been expecting civil war to break out, and each side was confident of victory. The American military advisory group, he went on, who had created the South Korean army, were convinced that one South Korean division could defeat three North Korean divisions, and Syngman Rhee had often boasted that if they were allowed to start, his forces could capture Pyongyang, the northern capital, in 3 days. These were ludicrous miscalculations, wrote Pratt. Pratt then quoted General MacArthur speaking at the U.S. Senate hearing on May 6, cited earlier. MacArthur had said, the South Koreans were no match for them at all, and the disposition by the South Koreans of their logistic potential was extraordinarily poor. They had put their supplies and equipment close to the 38th parallel. They hadn't developed any positions in depth. Everything between the 38th parallel and Seoul was in their area of depot, said MacArthur. When they lost that immediate line, they lost their supplies. They, meaning the South Korean army, were not able, apparently, to destroy them en masse, and so that at one initial stroke, this North Korean army had a new supply base in the area between the 38th parallel and Seoul, which enabled them to press south with their full strength of their base being immediately behind them. They no longer had to rely on the long distance from the Yalu River to get their supplies down. End quote. Those are the commands of General General Douglas MacArthur at the Senate's hearings 11 months into the war. One of the most telling pieces of evidence that Pratt presents was a story told by the internationally known historian and journalist John Gunther, who was in Tokyo planning to write a biography of MacArthur. On the morning of June 25th, he was dining with two officers from the U.S. occupation forces that were running Japan in the post-war period. One was called away from the table by an urgent phone message. When he returned, he passed on to his fellow officer and Gunther what the call had been about. Quote, "The South has just invaded the North." Well, that was all from a report published a year after the war began by longtime British Foreign Service official Sir John Pratt, titled "Korea, the Lie That Led to War," which you can find online. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sherif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. In the spring of 2017, the Palestinian Solidarity Committee at Harvard held a forum on campus featuring Palestinian and other voices exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation. Time will not permit us to bring you the entire forum, but you will hear two of the voices, Nadia Ben Youssef and Rhonda Wabe, and their presentations will fill all the time we have this morning. Nadia Ben Youssef is an attorney and the U.S. staff representative of the Palestinian Legal Defense Organization, ADALA, headquartered in Haifa. Rhonda Wabe is a PhD student in anthropology at Harvard, focusing her research on the effects of settler colonialism in the West Bank, and is the former International Advocacy Coordinator for ADAMIR, the Palestinian Prisoner Support Organization. We begin with Nadia Ben Youssef, followed by Rhonda Wabe.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for inviting me and for hosting this conversation, which is really an interesting one. And even the title of it, I think, is quite compelling, idea of prisoners, incarceration, and illegality broadly. And so I hope we get into some discussions, not only about Israel-Palestine, but as kind of we move this discussion, I think it would be a nice progression into a larger conversation about these issues globally. I want to start with an anecdote and then kind of move on to a presentation. But I was recently in Palestine, and I was in Aida Camp in Bethlehem, and I was walking around, just trying to do laundry or something. And there was a group of young boys who were going to tell me where to go to get my laundry done. And they were just chatting with me about what I was doing and asked, like, why are you here? What are you doing? And I said I was a lawyer. And they said, oh, for prison? For prisoners? And I said, well, I work for a human rights organization, and we do some work in prisons. And they all said, there were four of them, and they were between the ages of 12 and 14. And one said, my father is in prison. And the other said, my uncle is in prison. And the last one said, our classmate was just taken. And he was taken while we were there. A young 13-year-old boy was kidnapped at night and then held in detention. And they were immediately, one after the other, were talking about, and I've never had, obviously, in this, even in the United States, where you have communities who are facing and whose reality and daily reality is about incarceration and about social control in similar ways to Palestinians, I've never had a child who said, what do you do? I'm a lawyer. Say, for prisoners? It's not something that happens. It's not a conversation that happens. It is a reality for Palestinians in an important way. And I think when we start looking at systems of social control, and that's what I'll say, kind of looking at incarceration and criminalizing populations, you start getting a sense of what's going on with the state. And so I think it's a really useful lens to see what are the interests, what are the fears of the state, and though we're going to focus on Israel a bit, and we'll move into Mexico as well, but we start thinking a bit more about just tools of oppressive regimes and how they work. So I actually rarely do this, but I was trying to stick within 10 minutes, so I have 10 minutes of things to tell you. But one of the things I'm often asked, in even when we're talking about whatever system or issue of oppression we're talking about, home demolitions or incarceration, or why Palestine? Why am I focusing on Palestine? What do I think is useful about Palestine? And I have to say that Israel offers us a very painful and transparent expression of state power and the way that colonial legal regimes work. And I think when you're looking particularly at incarceration and imprisonment and captivity as a tool of empire, as a tool of the state, Palestine tells us something really important about how oppression works and how these systems and these structures are inevitable outcomes of states and systems that are founded on this lie or the myth of supremacy. You will find this in situations of oppression all around the world. If there is a lie of supremacy, in the case of Israel, of Jewish supremacy, if there's a lie in this country of white supremacy, and the institutions are founded on that lie, you're going to have this result. You're going to have criminalization of existence, of the non-valued members of that community. You're going to have, you know, all of these things that we'll discuss soon. So I just want to offer that the reason we think about Palestine and the reason why it's very edifying, it's an instructive thing for us as those of us who care about justice, who care about social change, is that it tells us the story very clearly. What's going on? What is the state thinking when it's going through these processes? So what I'm going to do over the next few minutes, you're going to keep me on time?
Yeah.
Do I have like 2 minutes left?
Nope, you have
okay,
six
enough.
Or seven.
All right. Just to walk through a bit of history of Palestinian citizens of Israel in particular. So Adana, Fatima said that it were the legal center for Arab minority rights in Israel, founded primarily to focus on the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And I want to use the law, so we're a legal center, we use the law to protect and promote the rights of Palestinians, but I want to use the law to explore what that says about the state, the sort of laws that are being passed. What is deemed illegal or criminal is really instructive in the case of Palestinian existence and resistance. And I think it's also important just in terms of how law works, really. Like, I like that this framing was prison, incarceration, and illegality is the topic of the panel. Like, what is deemed legal? Who is writing the laws that say that X or Y or Z is illegal? I think it's important for us to keep thinking about this, and then how it transfers into our own realities. So I'm going to talk about what Israeli law tells us about the state, and then the ways, just some examples of how the law is used to facilitate, one, subjugation, and I think what's more important is how it limits resistance. So what is being criminalized in Palestine and why you have mass incarceration of Palestinian people. What's being criminalized is, one, existence, and two, resistance. So the laws that are being passed, that have been passed, that have defined the relationship between Israel and Palestinians since the establishment of the state, since the Nakba, have all been about reducing the power of Palestinians. How do we limit their power? How do we control them? How do we control their resistance? So lastly, I'm just going to close on how we might, as a larger community, overcome that and how Israel is using those same tools today. So in broad sum, these, and I think I'm talking to a quite versed audience, but maybe you'll learn something useful, or even in the way that the narrative is presented, and you can push back if it's wrong. And you can raise your hand if you want me to stop. But basically, I want to just talk about Palestinian citizens of Israel broadly. So we understand who Palestinian citizens of Israel are. Palestinians are descendants, Palestinian citizens of Israel, descendants of Palestinians who, after the Nakba, after the catastrophe of 1948, when the state of Israel was established, remained in their homeland and overnight became what we call homeland minority, became a minority in their own land. So the vast majority of Palestinians became refugees when Israel was established. 750,000 people fled, were forced to flee. 500 villages were destroyed. The Nakba. Everyone's familiar with the word Nakba? We're going to remember it, and we're going to say it because it's going to come up again soon. Became refugees. 150,000 people stayed. 150,000 people stayed within the borders of the new state of Israel, and in 1952 were granted citizenship. Were granted citizenship. You're welcome, citizenship, to these 150,000 people who remained. But they lived under a military regime until 1966. And I want to talk about the military regime because it's important as we kind of move through this conversation of how similar means and methods of social control, including incarceration, but not only incarceration, were transferred. So it's important. Military regime from 1948 till 1966. What happens in 1967? Brenda's going to talk about what happens in 1967, 50 years ago, and how that's being transferred and how the military structure is being transferred to the OPT, the Occupied Palestinian Territory, and also kind of coming back. But so the military regime, what did that mean? Probably all can know well what a military regime means, not only because we know something about Israel-Palestine, but because we were probably here in the United States, some of us, in 2014, when there were tanks on the streets of Ferguson, if you remember. There were curfews. What does a military regime look like? Oftentimes when I'm speaking to a different kind of audience, when I say military regime, they know what military regime is because they live it in their communities. In the United States, curfews, militarized policing, police surveillance, in certain communities, communities of color, black and brown communities, know exactly what I'm talking about without having to know anything about what's going on in Palestine. But a military regime meant, of course, restrictions on freedom of movements, closed military zones, permit structures, administrative detention, which Renda will talk a bit about. And essentially what was happening during the military regime is that the presence of Palestinians in the state was defined as illegal. So all these emergency regulations, it was illegal to resist the confiscation of land, it was illegal to resist fragmentation of your community, so it was not possible to communicate with Palestinians in the West Bank. It was illegal to resist, you know, what was happening with regard to the denial of Palestinian refugees to return, so to aid in that was illegal. So Palestinians, the resistance of Palestinians to the military regime and to the new reality of a colonial state of Israel being planted on top of their homeland, any resistance to that was criminalized. So it's super important to think about the way that the law is used to say that this particular behavior is criminal. Your particular behavior is criminal. I would recommend at this point Professor Shira Robinson's book, Citizen Stranger, who looks at the military regime very closely. So the military regime was transferred in 1967, that Randa will talk about. But even when the military regime is lifted in 1967, the relationship between the state and Palestinian citizens is unchanged. essentially. So these people, though they are citizens, and we can talk in another lecture about what kind of citizenship Palestinians have, but though they were citizens, they're still viewed as security threats. That there's something about our relationship that requires me to have a very different relationship to you than to other citizens of the state, and in this case, the Jewish citizens of the state. So the military regime is lifted, but you're still being limited in pursuing rights to land, to planning, social economic rights, certainly civil and political rights. And when it's necessary, when the state needs to take it away, the state takes it away. The state takes away your rights. So your rights are conditional. And so just a few examples. 100,000 Palestinian Bedouin citizens of Israel live currently in the Nakab, in tens of what are called unrecognized villages. So this is another idea about the law as a tool of the powerful to say what is or is not legal. So villages that existed before the state of Israel, when the state of Israel was brought upon historic Palestine, the land was declared state land by law. The land is now state land. The people who are on the land are trespassers. You're on state land. The state, it became state land yesterday. But today, you're trespassers. So who writes the laws become very important in terms of what practices or what is becoming or deemed criminal. And so there are now over 50 laws in Israel that discriminate against Palestinians. And again, they're tools of social control. And they're tools, particularly, and I think it's important also for student activists, to stifle dissent, to stifle resistance. And what I hope is happening is not something that we're thinking really about Israel-Palestine, but that when we're reflecting on these issues, we're thinking about ourselves. We're thinking about the reality of law in this country and the way that the law is used, who it's written by, what interests are being protected, and that we're challenging the institution of law as an institution that is driven by an ideology of supremacy, an ideology in this country of white supremacy, an ideology in Israel of Jewish supremacy. And so the law reflects that, right? So what's being done and what is being stifled and who benefits from the law? So just a few examples.
Yeah, no problem.
2011, we saw a wave of discriminatory laws. So there's over 50 discriminatory laws on the books that discriminate against Palestinian citizens of Israel and Palestinians living under occupation. But I want to just touch on a few so we start thinking about what's being criminalized. What's being criminalized and what will bring you into the incarceration system. So 2011, the Nakba law. So we talked about the Nakba. We know what the Nakba is, the Nakba, the catastrophe. 2011, a law is passed that says if you're a public institution, your funding will be stripped if you commemorate the Nakba. The Nakba is coming up May 15. Libraries, theaters, universities, if you commemorate the establishment of the State of Israel as a day of mourning rather than as the day of independence, your public funding will be stripped. Memory is criminalized. Narrative and history is criminalized. That same year, Israel passed the Admissions Committee law. Admissions committees operate in 43% of all towns in Israel, 65% of rural communities, and basically says that we can let you in or not on the basis of whether you are socially suitable. So that means Palestinians are not allowed in, it means that the wrong kind of Jews are not allowed in, Mizrahi Sephardic Jews, Ethiopian Jews, single families, you can do all sorts of things. But if you're not socially suitable, we're not letting you in. Segregation and exclusion is legal. The boycott law, which we can talk about extensively here as well, made calling for a boycott a new civil tort. So a new civil wrong where you could be sued if you called for a boycott. Dissent is criminalized. And in the last couple of years, there's been a huge crackdown, particularly on the resistance of young people. Thinking about young people in particular, where is the strength of the resistance? And the strength of the resistance, whether in Palestine, in Mexico, in the United States, is led by young people. The spirit of resistance is led by young people. The vision of the world that they want is led by young people. So how can we cycle that? Last couple of years, if you remember in 2015, there was what was known as the ninth intifada, or the third intifada, where there were stabbings and there were issues and there were all sorts of new laws that were allowing shoot-to-kill policies. It became legal to shoot on suspicion and to kill on suspicion. There were minimum sentences for stone throwing. So you know that the throwing of the stones and the model of resistance that's was being criminalized, and so there was unlike any other law and any other crime in Israel, suddenly there was no discretion of the courts and there were minimum sentences for these little kids, or fines on the parents of stone throwers. So inside or outside of prison, and maybe in the Q&A, if there's more time, we can talk about what's going on in prisons, but I think that we'll talk about it a lot. We have to think about the role of the law in limiting resistance. And I want to just end with another anecdote, which shows kind of where I think the next stage is going and why these sort of conversations are very important and why thinking more broadly about this issue is the latest kind of threat, is the strength of the resistance. So I was in interrogation on my way to into Ben-Gurion Airport. If anyone's been to Ben-Gurion Airport and you have a particular name or look, you know the Arab room. So in the Arab room, there was in the Arab room.
And there's, there's a Latino room, too.
There's a Latino room. The brown room. Yeah. The brown and Latino. Gabriel, Mahmoud, like, everybody's there. So we're sitting in the Arab room, and I'm waiting for the interrogation, and I go into the first interrogation, the second, and then you know, in the second interrogation, it's a little bit more intense. In the second interrogation, a man named Jason is talking to me. So Jason, which, why is your name Jason? So they're like, where you come from, I don't understand. With a very strong American accent. But so Jason is talking to me about normal, like, where are you from, what are you doing, what's your father's name, what's your grandfather's name, what are you doing in Palestine, what are you doing in Israel, what's the situation, what's Adala, everything that you... And then you know there's a certain moment when the interrogation becomes serious. Right, so you're talking, and then it's kind of like nice, and you don't actually, it's like weird, it's interrogation, but there's a moment where it happens, where there's either the books are closed or the computer is moved and they look at you differently. And in the past 7 years, since I've been working with Adela and being in the Arab room situation, was in the past, the moment that happened, it was about who do you know that's organizing protests? Have you been in confrontation with the military? Who do you know in the political movements? Who's organizing on the ground? What's going on with the proper plan in the Naqab? What's happening? Trying to get who's doing the direct action and the resistance. Maybe three years ago, around the boycott law stuff, it started, BDS became a huge issue, right? So are you engaged in BDS? What are you doing with BDS? This time, get this. Jason's talking. Jason puts his book down and he said, tell me about intersectionality. Like this. This black feminist poet of like, and Kimberly Crenshaw, and he was like, that's not what I mean. We think it's extremely problematic, this idea that you're linking struggles that have nothing to do with each other, and it's, the government, thinks that it's a false comparison and that it's going to lead to nowhere, and he got crazy. He literally lost his mind over intersectionality. And I think that that's a reflection of why we need to move in a very different direction in terms of our struggle, and you guys know that, students know that, and you're dealing with this issue very differently. So a panel on incarceration can't just be about Palestine. It has to focus on Mexico. It has to focus on the incarceration of black and brown bodies in the United States. It has to be broader than that. That's where the threat is. When we start thinking of these systems as interlinked and we start recognizing that our role in the struggle is about reaching out to each other and creating a mass movement, that's what's scaring them now. So I would just encourage you, as they're trying to limit resistance, this is what they're trying to limit. Do not stop reaching out. I'm so proud of students who are doing this now. And I'll stop. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, hi.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lorenza. It's just photos, so. So today I'm going to, thank you, Nadia, that was incredible, and I'm going to take up from where you left off to 1967. I worked with an organization called Ad-Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Organization based in Ramallah. It was started about 30 years ago now, and the organization's primary role is to provide legal aid to Palestinian political prisoners. So exactly like what Nadia experienced in Aida camp, that was the type of work that we did. And so I'm also really happy that this panel is happening right now, especially because the 17th on Monday is Palestinian Political Prisoners Day. It's an annual event that happens to honor and commemorate the political prisoners and also to show support for their families who have often been stranded by political factions, by the political leadership as well. So the issue of incarceration and the issue of prisoners is one that is central to Palestinians and especially for liberation and justice and for us to see any type of solution in Palestine. Since 1967, there's been over 800,000 Palestinians that have been arrested by the Israeli occupying forces, which is one in every five Palestinians and 40% of the male population. Mm-hmm. So this situation affects every single family, every single person, just as Nadia explained right now. You can meet anyone in Palestine and they will tell you about a parent, a sibling, a friend that has been arrested at one point. They have probably seen someone being arrested at a checkpoint, experienced it in their own homes, and it is really something that has become prolific and really invaded every part of Palestinian intimate life. Just to take off a little bit about the military orders, so there's 1,600 military orders that govern every aspect of life in the West Bank, is exactly for the reasons that Nadia described, in order to control and suppress any kind of resistance. So, for example, every single political party is actually considered illegal, including Fatah, who are the Palestinian leadership that the Israeli government negotiates with. They are actually considered an illegal party. Gatherings of people are outlawed as well. The Israeli military governor can make any space in the West Bank a closed military zone at any instance. And we have some people who are on the Harvard Palestine trek here who can tell you that when we were in Palestine, we were on a bus a couple weeks ago or a month ago now, and the Israeli military saw us there, and they actually called that. They immediately said that was a closed military zone, and we were stuck on that bus for 2 or 3 hours because they had deemed it a closed military zone. Now, had we been Palestinians, many of us would have been arrested, probably. And that's just the reality that we live under there. Even traffic violations are criminalized under military law. Because the Israeli military controls all of the roads that connect the Palestinian cities in the West Bank, they often pull over Palestinians because Palestinians have different license plates than Israelis. Palestinians have white and green license plates. Israeli citizens have yellow license plates, so it's very easy to find a Palestinian and I'm blanking on that word. What is it? Racially profiled Palestinians on the roads. So, for example, if you're pulled over for speeding, if you're pulled over for not putting on your blinker, for going over the yellow lanes, obviously you can tell I haven't driven in a long time. I don't even know what things are. You can potentially go to prison and you will be fined. And so we see that there's an Israeli military industrial complex where incarceration is very closely tied to making money for the Israeli government. So 2 years ago, the Israeli military court actually published a report to say like how many people had been arrested for traffic violations, how much the fines that were incurred, and it was actually 3 million shekels, so almost $1 million worth of fines that were paid by Palestinians into the Israeli military courts. This excludes Palestinians who are arrested for under all of the other military orders who also pay fines in addition to in addition to serving sentences. So today what I want to talk about, because we only have 10 minutes and obviously we could talk about this for days, is on the 17th, on Palestinian Prisoners Day, there's actually going to be the launch of a mass hunger strike. And we haven't had a mass hunger strike among Palestinians for several years now because of the intense repression and attacks that the prisoners face when they go on hunger strike. When I was working in Ramallah, there were several hunger strikes of both individuals and mass hunger and collective strikes in which they faced severe repression, everything from beating, from being put into solitary confinement, from being transferred to different prisons, from being shackled, from being... sometimes they would tell us in the affidavits that they would dangle the force-feeding tubes in front of them to tell them that they would force-feed them, even though technically force-feeding is illegal. And maybe Nadia can talk about the legalities of that in the Q&A, because Adala was working on this legislation, against this legislation. So this is a really important and crucial moment where Palestinian prisoners need support, because without having solidarity, they will be left alone in the prisons. And actually, even sometimes when upon their release, they tell us when they come to our office that the soldiers, when they put them in the guards, when they put them in isolation or are beating them, tell them, no one even knows you're on hunger strike. We can kill you right now and no one will know. This is the level of repression that they're facing when they go on hunger strike. So this is a huge deal, and we need everyone's support here for the hunger strike. So just to give you some context, right now there's 6,300 Palestinians that are in Israeli prisons. 500 of them are under administrative detention, meaning they're being held without charge and without trial. There's 300 children in prison and 61 women that are in prison. So I'm going to talk about a couple of key issues and then talk about the demands of the prisoners. So there's 13 demands that the prisoners have created collectively that revolve around five different themes. One of them is for the resumption of family visits, which are currently on hold, for improved health care, for improved transportation and the end to solitary confinement, for access to education, and for the end of administrative detention. Okay, hold on. How much time do I have?
About 4 minutes.
Oh, God. Okay. All right, I'm going to skip that page. So let me just get straight into the demands and why they're really important. So this hunger strike is basically calling for improved conditions because of how horrific the conditions are in prison. Oftentimes there's at least 8 prisoners to a cell with 1 bathroom. They're extremely overcrowded. They're extremely filthy. They're all actually considered against international law because all of the prisons are inside of Israel or in historic Palestine, making them impossible for the families to be able to visit them without having permission both from the prison and from the state, because the state considers them entering into Israel. So the first demand, and the most important demand, is for the resumption of family visits. Can you go over 2 slides?
2 slides?
Yeah, next one.
This one?
Keep going. Here. Oh, yeah.
Back. Sorry, this one?
Actually, yeah, they're out of order, it seems.
Okay. Keep going.
No, keep it on that one. Okay, so the reason this family visits are so important is because this is the only form of support for the prisoners, and this is a way for the Israeli occupation to try to break resilience of the prisoners by keeping them away from their family. Oftentimes they hear, because family visits have been revoked, they oftentimes hear the news of what's happened if someone got married, if someone was born, if someone died in their family. They hear about it months later because they're not allowed to see their family, or they hear it through other people. So this is oftentimes the first line of punishment for prisoners, is to revoke family visits. And they do it in 2 different ways. So sometimes they will say the prisoner is fined for some reason for maybe acting up in the prison or for starting a hunger strike. So they will say you are denied family visits for 4 months or something like that. So that's oftentimes what happens. Or they will actually deny the family on the basis that they're a security threat. So they will say, and usually this happens once their children turn 16, they will immediately be deemed a security threat, especially if it's a male child. So usually family members between the ages of 16 and 45 are not allowed to visit their family member in prison. Only the first degree family members are allowed to visit. So meaning like parents, siblings, children, and your wife or husband or wife. But there, you need to prove that you are related to this person. So there was one case that we had where they did not allow for, they allowed for the prisoner's grandparents to visit them, but not their grandchild that had just been born. So this was also a way to try to put pressure on the prisoner by denying them from this like very exciting and joyous moment of their first grandchild being born. And it was because they said that their grandchild was not considered a first-degree relative. So only their child was considered, their son was considered a first-degree relative, but not his children. So this is why this is one of the most important issues that prisoners have, is to be able to have these family visits. Now, many of the family members actually put the responsibility on the Red Cross as well, for because the Red Cross is responsible for coordinating these visits, and the families say that they don't do enough to actually help prisoner family members who are denied for security reasons. So this photo is actually taken in Ramallah at a demonstration that happens weekly at the Red Cross office of family members. They're all holding photos of their family member who is in prison. And they feel very frustrated that the ICRC is bowing down to Israel's pressure for not allowing them to have visits, to the point where families used to be allowed to have 2 visits a month for 45 minutes, and the ICRC reduced them to 1 visit a month for 45 minutes. So one of the demands is to reinstate having bi-monthly visits for an hour and a half each time, and to allow more than first degree family members to come, and to for the ICRC to actually remove this process of security security check on the family members, so that all family members would be able to visit. And this, family visits are also used as a way to put as a form of collective punishment as well on prisoners. So, for example, in 2007, during the siege on Gaza, and in 2012, during every incursion on Gaza, basically, in 2014 and 2009, all families are not allowed to visit from Gaza. So they just, this is a form of collective punishment on them. During, while their families are being attacked and bombed and bombarded in Gaza, they're also not allowed to come and see their family members. So so this is why, this is one of their main and first demands. The second one is about medical negligence. So if you could go back to, so in the prison, there's a lot of deliberate medical negligence, as well as negligence. Sorry. For example, many prisoners say that the prison clinic becomes a point of collusion and collaboration for the prisoner. So when a prisoner attempts to go get medical care from the clinic, they ask them to collaborate with them, to give them information on other people in their cell, to give them any other information, which actually deters prisoners from actually going to the clinic. So this is one of the ways that they cause a lot of medical issues to happen inside the prison, because people are afraid of being either asked to be a collaborator, or if they do go to the clinic, then perhaps their fellow prisoners will no longer trust them or will maybe find them suspicious. There's also a lot of intentional delay in treatment, malpractice, medical procedure errors, failure to diagnose, and lack of proficiency and efficiency. The prisoners do not trust the medical practitioners. They often have very basic medical experience. One prisoner told me, one ex-prisoner told me he never went to the clinic in the 30 years that he was in prison. Because he said, look, underneath their white coat, they're wearing their soldier's uniform. So why would I go trust them with my life? And he told me many stories of how they would actually try to treat themselves in cases of, like, you know, toothaches and things like that, to actually just avoid going to the clinic. So I want to give two cases of medical negligence to show how it's actually used as a tool against prisoners. This is a photo of Maisara Abu Hamdiya, who died in prison in 2013 at the age of 61. Maisara had throat cancer for many, many years, and he was denied treatment. At first, they were just telling him nothing's wrong with you. They would just give him painkillers if he went to the clinic, or they would just deny him from going to the clinic as a form of punishment, or they also only allow a certain number of prisoners to visit the clinic every week or every month, and so they have to make their own decisions on who needs the most urgent medical care. So sometimes he wouldn't make it to the list, and he ultimately, his cancer continued to get worse and worse and worse. Ultimately, they allowed him to actually go see a doctor 3 weeks before his death. They did not allow his family to come visit him. He continued to be shackled to his hospital bed the entire time, and he died alone from throat cancer because of medical negligence and because they refused to give him any kind of treatment. Maisara is one of at least 51 prisoners that have died from medical negligence inside the prison. This doesn't include those who have died from complications of issues that they contracted in prison that went untreated for years, or from those who died from complications from long-term hunger strikes after they had been released. And if you could show me the next slide. This is a poster of Sa'ir Halahle, who is another hunger striker. He went on a hunger strike a few years ago for 77 days because he was under administrative detention without charge and without trial. And during Sa'ir's interrogation, he had to get a dental procedure that was really urgent. And so they actually did a tooth extraction, but they used non-sterile tools, and so he contracted hepatitis from this procedure. Now, instead of the Israelis actually taking a responsibility for this and giving him treatment, they told him, no, actually you contracted it from your wife because your wife has been cheating on you. And they tried to shame the entire family, and they forced his wife and his children to all get tested for hepatitis in order to prove that it was indeed from the prison. So this is also another tactic that's used on top of the medical negligence, is the utter humiliation of prisoners. And this was during his interrogation, and I didn't get a chance to talk about how horrific interrogation is, and torture, both physical and psychological torture, is used against prisoners in order to extract any kind of information from them. And so this was all happening during his interrogation as well. So improved medical care, in which prisoners can get health care outside of the prison clinic, is one of the demands for this hunger strike. To have routine care, to be able to get surgeries that they need by qualified professionals. And another thing is to also not have to pay for the medical treatment, because in cases when prisoners have been able to get medical treatment, they actually have to front the costs for the surgery or for the procedure that they need.
We're kind of running out of time a little bit, but I won't cut you off right now, but you could just
Okay, so the last thing I'll talk about is education. So one of the other, if you could go to two slides for now. I think it's just really important to bring in the stories of the people who we're actually fighting for. So this is why I go so far into depth in them. Okay, so this is Kefah Kuzmad. He's a senior at Birzeit University. A month ago, he was arrested. He went missing for several days. And then he was finally found in an interrogation center called the Russian Compound, which is one of the most difficult interrogation centers that Palestinians go through. Kefah was just put under administrative detention for 6 months, meaning he's being held without charge or trial indefinitely. This can be continued to be renewed. Kefah is a student activist. He's very outspoken. He's at all the many protests. He's a very and so he often speaks out against the occupation, against coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, which we could talk about later. And he's now currently in prison. He won't be able to graduate this semester as he had intended to. And this is the reality of many, many Palestinian students who are arrested in the middle of their semester, oftentimes during finals, and they are put, they're in prison for years and are not able to continue their education. So I just wanted to bring his case up to light. And it's often, I believe almost every single elected student body president has been arrested by the Israeli authorities. So this goes back to what you were saying about the youth and how they're trying to suppress the youth. In this case, in the case of university students, it's a very violent and direct way in which they actually round them up. They oftentimes go into the universities and raid the universities and take all their supplies and try to figure out who's in different political parties at the university to try to suppress any activity there. Because as we know, universities are where the resistance starts. I don't know if that's the case for Harvard, but I'm not sure. So the last point I want to make is one of their other key demands is actually to allow for continuing education inside the prisons, both for high school students and younger, and also to do university. Because in 2006, when an Israeli soldier was arrested in Gaza by Hamas, while the Israeli occupation forces were conducting a ground raid there, the prisoners faced a lot of punitive measures. And one of them, which is still in place today, is that they're not allowed to do any kind of formal education. So what their prisoners are asking for is to allow for education, allow for students to take their final exams, because a lot of child prisoners who are under the age of 18 actually end up dropping out after they go through the prison system, even if it's for a couple of months, because they get behind with their classmates and they don't want to start the 10th grade over and over and over again. And this is another way that the Israeli occupation is trying to break the resistance, is by trying to not even allow us an education. So I'll stop there, but just by saying, actually in Boston on April 17th, we're going to have an event for Political Prisoners Day. It's taking place at the Park Street train station at 4 p.m.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Nadia Ben Youssef and Rhonda Wabe speaking at a forum organized by the Palestine Solidarity Committee at Harvard University in the spring of 2017. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. We are broadcasting again from lovely Hayward, California, on the California State University East Bay campus. Feeling good today for another exciting show. Amy, why don't you tell us what's in store for us on the show today?
I am
Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. Today, the Project Censored show will examine critical studies regarding surveillance and authoritarianism. Our guest is Kalimba Kazito, a third-year doctoral student at the University of Memphis. His research interests are in critical media and cultural studies with a primary focus on exploring the role of emergent technologies as a cultural force. But first, a few reminders for our listeners. At this time, I would like to remind you of our projectcensored.org/podcast website. There you can check out past shows. For any feedback, questions, comments, concerns, please send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Now you can also catch us on Twitter. Both Nolan and Nick have Twitter accounts now. You can find Nolan at Nolan_Higdon, and you can find Nick at Dr. Dreadlocks. That is DocTorDredlocks.
Cool. Thank you, Amy. And keeping with our Twitter conversation from last week, keep sending me your names for Desiree. Next show, we will unveil Desiree's chosen name from the listeners.
Da 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 da.
Desiree's very excited. Also online, Nick has his videos posted, so take a look at our social media pages and try and watch the films that are available there. And we're going to do a show on movies and authoritarianism based off Nick's list, and we're doing that just for you, the listeners. In fact, speaking of social media, we received more calls again, this time about a guest we had about, I guess, a month or two ago, which was Dr. Catherine Olmsted from UC Davis. We received calls about how when she was on the show, we didn't make it clear that 9/11 was an inside job done by the government. I'll repeat something I've done at public events for 10 years, and it'll probably be ignored as it has been for the last decade. Project Censored is not a monolithic organization. Different people in the project have different views on different events, and that's a good thing. We believe in a diverse point of views. We believe in debate, critical debate, academic discussion. We had Dr. Olmsted on the show to talk about her work, which was about conspiracy theories and conspiracy culture. She was not on the show to talk about September 11th and the events of September 11, 2001. Thank you for ignoring me. More importantly, instead of calling us, leaving us messages, a much better way to get a hold of me, and if you actually want to engage with us here on the show, is contact us on Twitter or via email. We love having those discussions. We love bringing listener mail in. It's kind of tough in the phone calls. I can't really transcribe the message and bring it on the air. But if you do send an email or contact us with a direct message on Twitter, I'm happy to read it and discuss it on the air, as we've done numerous times on the show. There's so much news going on that I wanted to focus on this week. I thought one of the things we should probably start with that we were kind of talking about prior to the show, which was these transgender tweets from Donald Trump. And Trump just sort of has this brain fart that he's going to ban transgender people from being in the military, but he didn't actually talk to his generals. His generals came out shortly thereafter and said, no, there's no policy in place to do this. So I think it shows kind of this, before we get into the discrimination tactics here and why they have a massive impact, I think it also reveals that he does not know how to operate a government. He thinks he's a king and you can just say something and it becomes law. And this goes back to something on the campaign trail. He posited himself as this businessman and this corporate leader. He's actually never been in charge of a private corporation that had shareholders. So he never had anyone to answer to. He's always ran a family business. Now, his family was rich, and you know, he's famously born on third base and thought he had a triple. But when he has this power in a family business, you can fire people and decree things. You can't do that in government. So just to get that sort of out of the way about the tweet's actual impact on policy, I thought was important. But I don't know. I mean, at this point, Nick, Desiree, are you guys shocked anymore, or are you eye rolling at these events?
Well, the narcissism is bottomless. When you wake up in the morning and you say we've sunk to new depths, there are more to go. We're over 6 months in. There's more. There will be, barring impeachment, there will be 4 years of narcissistic depths to sink.
Yeah, I agree. And I think following anything that Trump does or says is like watching an OxyClean commercial where it's like, but wait, there's more. And it's just more bigotry and more racism. And I think with the trans situation, it's almost like he has a billboard and crosses out people of the month that he's going to attack. So it's going to be immigrants this month, and it's going to be trans, as if there are no trans immigrants or if there are no black immigrants, and then you separate them. And I don't know if that's his divide tactic, but I think it is eye-rollable and it is laughable. And it's, like Nolan said, it's funny to see how he views himself in his presidency, because I think it's the same as how most standard Americans view a president, as being all-powerful and the all-being, almost like Oz, where it's, no, he doesn't have the power to do a lot of the things that he talks about doing and that we believe he can do. I think the problem is when he gets people on board with him, or when he starts these campaigns that, for whatever reason, can kind of benefit maybe some people in Congress or some people, some Democrats or Republicans. That's when it really becomes a problem. But if it's just this narcissistic Gemini, and I'm a Gemini, so I know very well, him just sitting up there with his two personalities spewing all this, what's next? What's new?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, tweets are not policy. I think we all know that. Even if you didn't take civics, you know that tweets are not policy.
You should.
you should. If you don't know that, read up on that quickly.
This is an eye-opening experience.
Right. Second of all, there are 15,000 transgender American citizens who are in the military, in the volunteer military. Volunteer military, by the way, who are put themselves on the line and are willing to die for this country no matter what the agenda is, no matter what the corporate agenda is. There's only, and frankly, the U.S. military is the largest employer of transgender people in this country. Second of all, there's only $8 million that's actually allocated to transgender persons serving in the military for elective surgery and medical benefits that are specific to transgender people. So what Trump specifically did here was he bastardized a Republican desire to remove those health benefits and developed that into a full-on ban of transgender people in the military. Now, look, as you know, I've said many times on this program, and to paraphrase the journalist Chris Hedges, Trump is an idiot. He's just a flat idiot. We are now in a position, though, where I think that corporate power, the power of American oligarchs, and state military power, joined with that, which, by the way, is the formula for fascism, are so powerful that it doesn't matter if the idiocy is out in the streets. They can get away with it now. This is like the final stages of Rome. You can be a moron playing the violin while the country burns. It's in the open.
Yeah, I think on that point, I think this goes back to what Desiree said. You notice Desiree said the word tactic, and I thought that was just so on point, that his numbers are failing, his policy is failing in Congress, he's the lowest rated president ever at this point. And so then I think you pull out the old conservative or right-wing talking points, like, okay, let's go after transgender people in the military. You guys cared about that recently. And then he goes, gives the speech in front of police, right? Okay, so let's go back to police abusing people they arrest. All these things are tactics, right? It's saying, here, get with me. Here's our policy. Here's our program. Distraction, right? Because his comments about police, absolutely disgusting. And they fill the news and they create fodder. But again, it's distracting. In fact, he's not doing his job. There's no actual policy
there's
behind
nothing.
It.
There's no job being done. But if you look at the first 6 months here, let's go after women. Let's go after the news media. Let's go after women in the news media. Let's go after transgender folk. Let's ignore the invitations of blacks, even conservative, relatively conservative organizations like the NAACP. Frankly, if you're a black radical activist, NAACP is relatively mainstream. But let's ignore them as well. I mentioned immigrants. Let's go after gangs. Okay. Let's go after Chicago. Because Chicago has gangs, and on and on and on and on and on. But it is a circus. It is a distraction. It is like being in the Colosseum watching gladiator fights. So this week, it is Trump the gladiator versus the transgender. And we're all distracted by this show. Ooh, who's going to win? Is the transgender going to win or is Trump going to win? Well, but that's not really the issue. The issue is, again, we've got, as American citizens and as responsible people in the media, we've got to follow the money.
Yeah. Also, to add to that and kind of what I was saying earlier about the danger being in when people jump on the bandwagon and just hear what they want to hear first and roll with that, I think just days later, just a couple days ago, there was another radio show, The Breakfast Club, which is really popular, especially in urban communities. But there was a comment being made about if a certain individual found out that he was dating a transgender, he would kill him. And people just kind of chuckled and laughed. Do you know how many transgender people are killed? It's ridiculous to even joke about that. And it's seemingly not a joke because there's always some kind of truth to it. And when you're being backed by a president who has the same kind of sentiments, or it almost does, that's what I think is really dangerous. And people who have platforms like Spencer or some other people know about all these issues, that's when it kind of picks up and it becomes scary because people become on the accord, or maybe they want to be on the same accord as a president or want to. So that's, I think, what's really dangerous. And in the same week, if we're hearing the same thing, you can only imagine what can come from that.
It is dangerous. I teach a course on sexuality, African-American sexuality, here at East Bay, and we talk about this quite a bit. And I, over the years, I've been teaching this class since 2000. We don't get as many of these comments anymore, fortunately, because people are evolving. But I used to get those comments that when I would expose students who were heterosexist or deeply steeped in heteronormativity, and we would talk about transgender identity, they would say, well, the thing I got out, particularly men, okay, and we're talking about this fragile black masculinity, they would often say to me, hey, what I got out of this section is the next time I go out with somebody, I'm going to reach down there and try to figure out what's going on before I start getting involved. So you either get that sort of violent, fragile black masculine approach, or you get the opposite, which is in private. Sometimes students will tell you about how they fetishize, especially male to female transgender citizens. Neither of which are ways in which we need to ethically and responsibly and lovingly deal with our fellow transgender citizens in this country.
On this idea of using this as tactics, the language, and I think Desiree was on point too by saying that you connect this to actual actions that happen. Other leaders have been doing this as well. Like Duterte has done this as well with his war on drugs. Duterte is the president of the Philippines. He's done this with his war on drugs and his threats to bomb indigenous schools. And we hear this rhetoric here in the States, right? And we think, God, those people are so nuts over there, right? That leadership. Mm-hmm. But we have to remember, to Desiree's point, that's what's happening here, right? People are seeing this from Trump and hearing this around the world. And it does end up inspiring individuals to do violence. We've seen this for years, right? The old excuse, I just said it. I didn't know anybody was actually going to go out and do it. But I also think that we've talked about before, they're tapping into a lot of legitimate anger. And I want to sort of shift focus into another topic where sometimes I think leftists give some red meat to this conservative anger that makes it tough for progressives to kind of combat. There's been this discussion of how there's this war on free speech coming from the left, right? And they point to UC Berkeley blocking Milo and Ann Coulter from giving speeches. And my position on that remains, there's a big difference. Those are not academics. That's sort of like it's a public institution giving them a platform. And you're not really curtailing free speech because only the government can do that, not student protesters. But here in the Bay Area, there's a big difference. The KPFA news stations blocked a public event with Richard Dawkins. And people who don't know, Richard Dawkins is a scholar of religious studies and civilization. And they censored his speech, presumably about some of the comments he had made about the Islamic faith. And I draw a distinction here between blocking Dawkins as opposed to Coulter or Milo. Dawkins is an academic grounded in literature and has a conclusion based on evidence. That doesn't mean you have to agree with it. But at least for this idea, for people who believe in sort of having discussions, Dawkins clearly someone who's bringing evidence to the table to discuss. And I think that this conservative anger points to these type of actions to justify why they say they believe the left is actually attacking them instead of Duterte and the transgender comments and Trump's police comments. So I kind of wonder what you thought about this decision by KPFA to censor Dawkins, or if you can consider it censorship.
Yeah, it's especially when you want to make the contrast between the two, Dawkins with Yiannopoulos. Milo is specifically engaged in hate speech. And why do I say that? Because part of the protests that happened at Berkeley surrounded the fact that Milo had the intention of outing and naming specific people during his discussion. You have, I think people have lost the concept of what free speech is. You say what you want to say, but you cannot specifically incite violence towards other individuals. The boundary line for all of your rights within a representative democracy ends when the exercise of your rights and your freedoms impinges on the rights and freedoms of other individuals in the society. So this is where the line is for me. It's not just the line between what is intellectual and what is pablum, because there is also that distinction between Yiannopoulos and Dawkins. And I think that that's relevant, especially if you're an intellectual and you're trying to deal with something at any level of depth. I take issue with censoring folk who are not engaged in hate speech, but who are engaged in presenting an argument. I don't have to agree with your argument, but if it's an argument and we're not targeting individuals, people are not leaving the auditorium with names or with some idea about being violent to others and destroying their rights, then I have no problem with what you with your argument, with your speech.
I think that this is such a relevant argument, and I can only think about going back to Facebook and platforms like that, where I myself, family members, and a lot of other people I know are being flagged, being deleted complete on simple posts like in Malcolm X quote. And then you have the total opposite, where I have a hate speech racist slur commented on one of my pictures, and it's been, and I didn't even check it for months, but it's been up there forever. And it's just laughable, because I think that it kind of is up to who is in control of the concept of free speech, because I think a lot of people's idea on hate speech being free speech comes from what we see from the presidency and from all these people who are quote unquote in charge, who get away with spewing hate speech and covering it up as free speech, but then we don't even really have the opportunity to assemble freely and to speak freely on our own land on topics that directly affect us and that are real fact-based topics like oppression and poverty, where we can fight and back it up. And if we have ideas against the system or against the European society standard, that's hate speech to many people, to the majority of the population. But then vice versa, you can say you hate Islam and hate all the people of that faith, and that's just free speech, and it's not fair. But how can you, should it be fair? Is there anybody that can even, I don't know, deem what's fair and what's not, and who's to say who's going to be in charge? There's no tracking system or anything to really deal with that. It's just people slip under the radar and reconstitute how we see free speech, and that's where we are now today.
Yeah, I mean, the only other way that you can deal with that is in the courts through slander and libel laws, and not everyone has access to be able to do that. But I think you bring up a very powerful point. Speaking truth to power is really at the core of freedom of speech in the country. It's not about my right to talk about whether I liked Wonder Woman as opposed to Spider-Man or some inane other social comment about something that doesn't matter. It's about my ability to speak truth to power. And that's really where I think as American citizens we're being progressively shut down. And I think that that's certainly happened since the 1960s. You know, do I have a right to really critique the capitalist order in the public sphere? And as a professor, do I or do I not have the right to speak to power, truth to power, in front of my students without being accused of brainwashing my students, when in fact all I'm trying to do is provide them with the tools of critique, which they can do whatever with that they want to do, okay? But do I have the right to do that as a professor? Do we have the right to, certainly the news media to a degree has, I think, really abdicated that right. And what's funny to me about the news media is that they pretend to speak truth to power, but they're not really substantive. They're not really hitting it where it really is. They're not really showing you where the money is and where the power is.
Also, I want to pick up on that classroom theme. I think it applies to media as well. That we celebrate, and for some reasons rightfully so, that we're able to kind of cater our lives to and what we consume to the way we want it, right? We can watch shows when we want. We can watch what we want when we want. We can get it wherever we want and whatever device we want. So we have this ability to customize on so many levels. Part of that, though, I think customization behavior has been we've customized out either inconvenient truths or just things we don't like to hear. And I think you saw this with Dawkins at KPFA. And I think there's a frustration in the classroom that some students have to listen to things they don't want to hear. But that kind of undermines the point, and on news media as well, but that undermines the point, I think, of news media and traditional classroom education, which is you're supposed to hear things you don't want to hear and then draw your own conclusions. The only real atrocity, I think, is if a teacher judges you on whether or not they adopt their opinion. If your grade depends on that, I think that's the only atrocity. But as far as sharing opinions in the classroom, that's what that space is for. It's mm-hmm. one of the best space on earth, and in news media as well. But given, I think, this customization we've seen become more and more accessible, people have used that as a way to block out things they don't like. And I think the conservatives especially have been able, as you both pointed out earlier, have been able to conflate hate speech with free speech, right? So that when you combat hate speech, which is illegal, as you point out, then you're somehow stepping on someone's free speech. And without the knowledge of sort of experiencing different voices and a diversity of voices, I think individuals aren't able to tell the difference anymore.
Yeah, and I think we've moved away from Socratic and Platonic pedagogical principles. In a country that claims that it is at war, that the Western civilization is, whatever that is under threat, right? Ironically, we have sort of disavowed core Western principles, Greek principles, for example, which, by the way, and I don't really want to get into this right now, aren't purely Western European, but developed in the Mediterranean, which was a very heterogeneous environment, North African. But, you know, we could go on. Okay. These are really world principles that are shared, have been shared globally. But this notion that education comes from discursive encounter, right? From argumentation, from buttressing one idea up against the other, and from making arguments that are based on fact and some facts that we can agree upon, facts that are as cold and as objective as what the temperature is right now, right? We've moved away from this. It's conjecture. It's not fact-based. People who are in our news media who spout opinions often spout opinions that have absolutely no grounding to facts. They're ahistorical. And I think as a country, we're entering into some really critical times here where we need important debate. For example, North Korea. We're having a debate about North Korea being able to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles in 2018, but it is an ahistorical discussion. We are not, and it is a discussion that is devoid of fact, in the sense that we're not talking about the Korean War, or the atrocities that we committed in North Korea, that North Koreans have a memory of. We're not talking about military exercises that are ongoing in that region by the United States. What we are talking about is the fact that Kim Jong-un is a nut. Now, two things may equally true. Kim Jong-un may be a nut. I do not know him personally, as Dennis Rodman knows him personally. But
that's where I get all my news
from Dennis Rodman, yes. And his tweets. And by the way, I'm not actually sure that Dennis Rodman is on Twitter, but I am going to check after this broadcast.
See, Desiree, everyone's on Twitter.
Yeah, if Rodman's on Twitter, then yeah.
Yeah, if he is, I'll try to confirm that with you. But, I mean, there's a lot going on here. We're not having a substantive fact-based dialogue about this. And policy is going to be created around a non-fact-based, non-fact-grounded discussion in the nuclear age.
Well, he does it to us every week. We talk about one tweet, and we cover our entire roundtable. All right, we'll be back with our guest, Kalimba Kizito, after this short musical break. Welcome. We'll be right back. Back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Baham III.
We're here with Kalemba Kizito, who is a third-year doctoral student at the University of Memphis. He was born and raised in Uganda, where he earned his Bachelor of Laws at Makerere?
That's correct.
Makerere University, before moving on to the United States. He later earned his Master of Arts degree in communication at Cal State East Bay, where he briefly taught as a part-time lecturer, as well as at Ohlone College, before moving to Memphis to pursue doctoral studies. His research interests are in critical media and cultural studies, with a primary focus on exploring the role of emergent technologies as a cultural force, interrogating their evolution and transformation as technologies of statecraft. Currently, he is looking at how surveillance and its extensive apparatuses function to politicize, propagate, and maintain difference in society. Through his research, he aims to draw connections to the historical dimensions of constructing difference and the role different technologies have and continue to play in that regard. So welcome, Kalemba. Welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here.
We want to really talk to you within the context of sort of an ongoing series that we've had about emerging global expressions of global authoritarianism. So authoritarianism, generally speaking, the surveillance society and surveillance theory. And then we also want to talk to you a little bit more specifically about Uganda. So the first question I want to ask you is, what informs your understanding of the resurgence in authoritarian, extremist, and right-wing governments across the globe?
Thank you again for having me here. In response to that question, my own thinking is that if you take each particular geography and look at what the context is locally and what is going on in there, then you can start to map out connections as to what is causing this. For instance, in Europe, that migration pattern of bodies coming in from the coast of Africa is causing a lot of panic. Then when you look here, you could pick a starting point. But in my case, I'll start with the rise of Obama into office and that concomitant rise of the Tea Party. And that set the ground, at least in immediate history, for what is happening all the way building into Trump. And you can make connections between take our country back and make America great again. So when you start to weave these together, you can see that the sentiments kind of laid in, you know, with the rise of Obama, and that stayed right there. And then that led to the emergence finally of Trump. And what follows after that, I think, is an appeasement to that sentiment that wants a very hard-driven policy towards, you know, an approach to the world.
There's a compelling economic argument for anxieties that are triggered by globalization. I think you've alluded to that a little bit. In globalization impacting workers all over the world, and that explains to a degree some justified anger reflected in the uptake in the politics of divisiveness. What is your comment on that particular perspective?
The opening of national mobilities, borders opening up across our countries and nations, has caused a little bit of anxiety, as we can all attest to. On the one hand, we have capital moving from the West to the global South, and on the other hand, we have bodies moving from the global South towards the West, and both centered in an economic argument. People look seeking survival across into the West, and capital seeking to multiply itself and regenerate by migrating southwards. And when you look at this interplay between the movement on the one hand of bodies for economic reasons, seeking greener pastures, as it's called, and then capital seeking more lucrative ways of multiplying itself to the global South. So that tension kind of has led to this build-up in which you see that economics is at the center. It's on the table, but we are looking at it from different areas. On the one hand, it's about survival. On the other hand, it's about regeneration and multiplication of profit.
This is Nolan Higdon. I noticed that some of your work is in surveillance and these new technologies. And you're talking about globalization, and we mean that we're talking about just free trade and people working, buying, living across borders that almost don't matter in some respect, but others they do. What do you see as the connection between what I would call like a rise in surveillance and globalization? Is there a connection to the two? Does one cause the other?
For my research, I would argue that if you look into history, you realize that the connection has always been there, because what we're looking at as globalization today had already been tackled through the process of global exploration under the historical Royal Geographical Society and so forth, and all those expeditions that went around the world under the term exploration. But in the sense, they were mapping resources across different geographies around the world. And so, in a sense, personally, for my research, I would argue that that was the template for which globalization 2.0 is now really building upon. And so that process of, if you really look at a critical approach to cartography and mapping and so forth, those were ways of knowing which resources are where, both human and natural resources. And that is the template on which the current web of globalization is operating, knowing where resources are and how to monitor those resources. That's where surveillance comes in, knowing which is which and what is where and how to extract that.
Is it possible for you to define this area? I'm fascinated by this area that you're dealing with, of what's being called surveillance theory.
Surveillance theory has become very prominent. I would map it on two historical points. After 9/11 and after Edward Snowden. So after 9/11, the security state kicks in, and it is important to protect the good citizens of this country from the bad guys who are likely to come in and cause harm. And so all these measures, starting from the Patriot Act, have to be amped up. So we need to monitor which bodies are deviant and how to extract them from society. And so that speculation went on for quite some time. And the domestic debate was about, okay, how much privacy are we giving up? And all this conversation about these new technologies, social media platforms all cropped up, and how they are leading into big brothering of society. But then all that speculation was killed after Edward Snowden. So when he came up with those revelations, so he'd say, okay, it's no longer speculation. All of this information is being scooped up, and we are trying to gather everything and everything we possibly can about everybody and all modes of communication. And so now it opens up the field to where now we're going to ask ourselves, what's the way forward? Prior to that, the speculation was that, okay, everything is being tapped into, but now that we know that we are being observed, being followed, so where does the frenzy go from here? Now, as a student of history, I am trying not to get into that particular debate and then look back again into history and look at how the architecture or the templates for which modern surveillance is taking place had already existed in the laboratory of colonialism and imperialism. The way they managed the colonies and methods of administration had already set forth the template on which modern technologies of surveillance are operating.
Interesting.
Currently looking at how human behavior changes in the classroom based on surveillance, mm-hmm. and looking at the contemporary sense. And I wonder, you said you look at these things as a student of history. So historically, can you tell us, give me a little brief history on sort of the dramatic changes people have had to surveillance, as when they know they're being surveilled, how they may have changed their behaviors to kind of either adapt or resist surveillance?
I wouldn't say that I have explored that area, that particular question in depth, but my take on that in very, very sketchy research I'm looking at is that surveillance has been commodified in a way that it has muted the effect of people being under observation, because they have by commodification of surveillance, I mean that we have accepted that, well, hey, if you have any piece of digital equipment, it is up for grabs. You know, that somebody can listen in, can tap it in. But because we like these gadgets or devices and they help us make our life a little easier, we are willing to trade in that. And so the effect that would have happened in society in terms of an uproar as a result of all these revelations of surveillance hasn't taken effect because of what I argue is the commodification of surveillance, because it has been embedded into these consumer technologies that we cannot live without. And so it becomes hard for us to wage a pushback against them, whereas while we are benefiting from them. And so being under a surveillance gaze has, to me, I think, not really had the impact it has in terms of anticipated uproar.
Kalim, I had an interesting question where I was thinking, because you have experience being African, being from Africa, or having spent time there and being in America, how you view the ideology that we have around Africa and around them being behind, in a sense, especially as far as technology and industrialization, because we have here iPhones where we have materials being used like coltan that are being mined and being stolen from Africa, and kind of having painted a picture of the constant poverty and devastation that Africa faces, which is not all that Africa faces. That's the one aspect of it, versus new stories coming out. One of the leading new car manufacturers coming out of Africa and kind of competing with our cars here today. How do you view how we feel about it, and what's your experience experiencing both worlds?
Thank you for the question. The way I look at it in context of my research in surveillance, when people ask the question that how come Africa is still the way it is, or how come it is not developing, and I think that is where further research into how surveillance works, especially from a critical post-colonial approach, would help us answer such a question. Every area that had resources in Africa was mapped by early explorers. They knew where natural resources are, where human resources are, everything. They knew where to go get what. And if you remember that the context of the scramble and partition for Africa happened at a point when Europe was industrializing and now figuring out where they're going to get resources, not just for the immediate short term, but for the long term. They need resources and markets to build up their economies. And so the way surveillance ties into this particular question is, so you have to bring in other institutions, organizations, to keep the peoples, like in Africa, at bay. So for that forever, they're going to remain either a market for exporting of goods, or an area from which our raw materials can be extracted. And how does that surveillance now come into play? When you look at institutions like, say, the IMF and other, even philanthropic organizations, the role they play on the continent is to monitor what is going on and feed it to, I prefer to use the term empire, back home. That is how Africa is monitored, and that is why it never is able to make progress, because every step it tries to make, somebody is watching over and making sure that things remain the way they are. And I don't know if this can tie into that, but I have a very poignant example in a paper I just finished writing, which was looking at the recent rise in state-led homophobia in Uganda particularly. But when you look at it and you go back into history, you look at the fact that the missionaries helped really sow these seeds when they brought in Christianity, and they set the tone that this is how behavior, human behavior should be. And then they brought in their laws for my country, because we're a British colony, and also they imported the British penal system and partly incorporated it into our current legal structure. And so in such ways, when you look at how Africa remains behind, or how it is monitored, it is through these historical projects of statecraft, managing empire and administration, that is set the foundation to make sure that several years later they could come back and keep the situation at bay.
When we're talking about the surveillance infrastructure, I noticed that you're talking about mapping and missionaries as a way of keeping track of resources. But we often in the present day think of surveillance having to do with these digital technologies. So do you encounter a lot of pushback for people who think that maybe keeping a map of resources is not technically surveillance? How would you respond to that claim?
From an Afrocentric point of view, coming from a continent that has been ravaged the way it has, I would stand up against anybody who would make that argument that that was simply exploration. And I think that is where restudying history becomes very important, because the representation of what happened during those imperial voyages was one way of telling a story, but it was a particular narrative based on who was writing that history. And if you go by the African proverb that until lions have their historians, the tales of the hunt will always glorify the hunter, then that will continue to be the case. But when we start to tell our own history, then we can reinterpret what that meant and contextualize it into modern debates about surveillance and authoritarianism and so forth. Because that is how we would view it. That we, see, for instance, in my country, when they were building the railway lines, moved from the ports to where resources were. The infrastructure did not really extend so much into where there was nothing to be gained. Except from Mombasa to the Kilembe mines somewhere in the western part of Uganda, you could see that that railway line was meant to profit. You know, whoever was going to extract that copper from that belt and then take it out. And so did the slave trade route. They came to where they can get people, move human cargo from this point to that point to the sea and off to the west. So I would really push back strongly about that interpretation of surveillance.
So as a student of history, and I also study critical media studies as well, I find this really fascinating. And so when you talk about this historic trajectory, I noticed for the first part what we talked about so far, you talked about resources and mapping regions, and you talked about people in groups. But when do we get to the point in history where we're surveilling individuals? We start talking about individual surveillance. Can you talk a little bit about how that exchange happens?
I think surveillance has always and will always kind of be about individuals. It's always about bodies, which bodies are accepted and which are not. And those boundaries are always created maybe through legislation and different kind of means, different cultural ways of drawing boundaries. But what you're trying to do is to monitor the movement of bodies from one boundary to another, to protect it from here or there. And so the gaze is about bodies. It really is about bodies and which bodies are acceptable and not acceptable. Just, I think, was it this week? Trump tweeted about the transgender people not being accepting the army and stuff. You could see that it is always, there is always something located in the physicality of the body, that it's going to be a black body, a transgender body, or this kind of body, but the focus of the gaze is always on a particular body and the type of deviance that is inscribed on that particular body.
Interestingly enough, my discipline of anthropology, which I have my master's and my doctorate, is profoundly involved. Anthropology was profoundly involved in this project of surveillance, as I'm hearing it from you. I mean, anthropology is part of the colonial project. Only really since the 1980s and subaltern scholars in India has the lion begun to tell his or her story about this particular trade and surveillance. What I'm interested in, too, are things where the individual body that has been surveilled gains access to technology that allows them to turn the surveillance on the one who has always surveilled them, or allows them access to equal the scales. So recently, there was an assassination in Kenya. I don't know if you followed that, around revising election procedures by introducing biometric technologies into voting. I know that it was a close election, okay? And so part of this was about tilting the scales on that. But it seems as though when the people get their hands on something that's technological in Africa and in the rest of the world, that there's some attempt to destabilize that.
I suddenly heard about that gentleman who just passed away in Kenya, who was responsible gatekeeping, you know, the electoral process in terms of the computer work. Really sad. I don't know if I can speculate as to how what's going on in Kenya. Really, I can't. But the way this what I can say about the technologies, I mean, I try to look at them as tools. Now, the question would be that, is it possible for us to get the tools, the bodies that are subject to the gaze, to get the tools and flip the gaze onto the person who's gazing at them and or maybe gaze back at them? As a practical question, maybe that is possible to happen, but when I push this further, I think it should be less about the tools and we really have to go back and investigate what it is in the human condition that would cause us to appropriate these tools to subjugate other people. Because if it becomes about that in the immediate short run, it can leverage things, just like North Korea would We saw what happened in Libya, for instance, so we're maintaining our nukes. You got them, we got them, so we had a stalemate. But that does not resolve the tension between the two parties. And I think it really would come down to, I think, what it means to be a human being and respect other human beings the way you'd want to be respected. And the conversation for me has to shift from the technologies to that level whereby the conversation has got to be had as human beings.
All right, you're listening to the Project Censored Show, and I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Bayham III, and we are talking to Kalima Kazito, and we will be back after this short musical break. Welcome. Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. We are talking to Kalima Kazito. Kalima is a doctoral student at the University of Memphis and his research focuses on critical media and cultural studies with a primary focus on exploring the role of emergent technologies as a cultural force.
Kalima, I wanted to echo what you said about emphasizing the pillaging in Africa and everything that's gone on throughout and almost the race between a lot of established colonies or empires to kind of run back to Africa and revisit maybe what they have forgotten or maybe what they forgot they had mapped, like you said, about resources. So where you have China now, who I think is just now opening their first military base in Africa. Now there's a big debate about whether they should teach Chinese in schools as another language, and almost the fight between maybe India and China about who's really the first to maybe merge or explode in Africa today versus Africa 30 years ago.
Hmm. China is, by all means, a colonizing force, no doubt about that. And scholars will get into the difference between European colonialism and Chinese colonialism, but on the ground, from what I have gathered, African governments are more willing to work with China more than they are willing to work with the West. Now, granted, there has been enough history for them to make that decision and say, okay, we're going to work with China as our new partner. But there are a few distinctions here. China has come in strictly on a business front. We're doing business with you, so you might know they're exploiting you, extracting you, but give you this in return, and we'll extract this much in return. And they do not get engaged into any kind of politics or cultural stuff. It's just, they're the businessmen, you know, they're there to exploit, so that's what you get. And then, on the other hand, in the West, as you all have studied this, the colonial script, in Africa, they say the flag followed the cross, so you had to bring in pacifying force, Christianity, then you get into cultural wars of people, what is acceptable, you cannot do this, and with that, then you get then the political part of it, that's where empire comes in, and it's imperial administration, the education and the schools. So those are two different styles. Now, as an African, I would say that both of them are colonizing forces. And how can Africa respond and read? And if it were up to me, I would make this a compulsory read. Chinwezu's book, The West and the Rest of Us, to really rethink about this entire colonial project in its historical context and see if lessons can be really drawn by Africans on how to proceed. But right now, I don't know if I can suggest anything that would not put them from one colonial power into the hands of another colonial power.
It kind of seems like you were at the beginning of that talking about engaging in a strategy, which is aligning with China, definitely a colonizing force, but kind of like the enemy is my friend. Maybe creating that power vacuum with China, the U.S., Russia, India, right? There's kind of a power vacuum. We're seeing a splitting of power.
This is Nick Bahame. It seems to me that on, along the lines of this discussion, that there are two important historical examples. There's a 1955 Conference of Bandung with recently liberated African and Asian nations, something that was very moving to developing Malcolm X. And then there's also the example of Japanese colonialism leading up to World War II. Where Japan presented themselves as a kindler, gentler face of colonialism for Asia, as sort of a contrast to European colonialism. And it seems to me that what you're helping us to understand is that between those two historical examples, the China's incursion into Africa veers more towards that Japanese example than the example of Bandung. It seems to me that it's more of the Japanese example of we're going to be a kindler, gentler, more capitalist-centered, purely capitalist-centered face of colonialism than what the Europeans did to you for centuries. Is that an accurate? First of all, are those sort of historical metaphors accurate in terms of defining the sort of different polar axes?
Yeah, it seems accurate. And like I was saying in the beginning, that they still remain different stripes of colonialism. And to me, I think it elevates the dilemma for the future about Africa. Because if you're just switching from one colonial force to another, then your future is still not guaranteed, if I might put it that way. And so all the strong presidents of the 60s, the Nkrumahs, Samora Machels, and all those people, now that they're all gone, and then we have a new wave of just corrupt, pilfering presidents. So the stakes are very high about what happens down the line in Africa. And as long as Africa is still in the condition in which it is, the condition of black people, I think, all over the world still remains in question, because that the motherland has to really be liberated for personally, I think, for black people elsewhere in the diaspora to really regain their sense of true worth. And as long as we still have these competing colonial forces with their gaze set on Africa, with no formidable response from within the continent, then the problem still remains. Is still there.
So, Kalimba, where can people get a hold of you or access your work?
Surveillance and Society, this leading journal that deals with surveillance theory, should be, it's an open access journal, it's online, and some of my work is on their website, Surveillance and Society. And I can also be reached via email, University of Memphis Communication Department. Once they go to that website, my work is available under my profile over there.
You don't have a Twitter account?
Yeah, exactly. We're into Twitter accounts.
You know, that is very, very interesting. And I don't know, because as a student of communication, I do not own any social media platform. And
you don't want to be surveilled.
It's my act of resistance.
Yeah. You practice
what
you preach.
I try not to.
All right.
Yes.
See, guys, I'm not just me.
Maybe you're right.
Oh, you should
join Desiree.
I have an Instagram and a Facebook that I use to surveil Facebook. But that's it.
No. Well, look what we did. We opened the doorway for Desiree to get out. All right. Listen, Kalimba, great guest. He is Kalimba Kizito. That's K-A-L-E-M-B-A. Last name K-I-Z-I-T-O. It was a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be back after this short musical break. Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Bahame III. At the Media Freedom Foundation, we produce content that illuminates the work of fact-based journalists around the world and offers alternative narratives to the corporate press. Amy Casey is here to tell us more.
Greetings,
listeners. This is Amy Casey of the Media Freedom Foundation with some highlights of student-generated content featuring authoritarian themes. From Diablo Valley College, Project Censored Director Mickey Huff and his student Christopher Krause have nominated a validated independent news story that is a story ignored by the corporate press but covered by the independent press, titled Billionaire Trump Advisor to Make Mass Profits from Mass Deportation While Violating Civil Liberties. The story reports of the impending September launch of a $20 billion data mining firm by President Trump's defense advisor, Peter Thiel, and his company, Palantir Technologies. The technology created by the firm will allow the collection and consolidation of information on up to 11 million people living undocumented in the U.S. to assist the impending mass deportations, in addition to the capability of targeting U.S. citizens in the future. That can be found at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, this time from Citrus College, Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and his student Michael Anthony Valdez Jr. have published Israel to Deport Pro-Palestinian Activists and Outlaw Foreign Supporters. The article identified the proposed Israeli legislation aimed to effectively outlaw BDS activists and foreign supporters of the pro-Palestinian human rights movement. This VIN can be found at projectcensored.org. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to check out projectcensored.org/podcast. There you can access free content and show your support for the Project Censored show. For any feedback, questions, comments, concerns, please send us an email to projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Nick and Nolan have joined the Twitter sphere. You can reach them at Nolan_Higdon or Dr. Dreadlocks. That's DOCTORDREDLOCKS. I'm Amy Casey, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thank you very much, Amy, and thank you very much to our guests. You've been listening to the Project Censored show. I'm Nolan Higdon with Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Bayham III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are our executive producers and hosts. Our intern and special announcer is Amy Casey. Mitch Scorza is our director and engineer. Project Censored show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. And visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all our radio shows for the past 6 years, as well as 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terrible.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
he urged, and the right has since incited, a kind of generational class warfare to tell younger people that they're providing a tremendous welfare subsidy, was the phrase, for the aged. You know, and tell me any conservative anywhere in the world that would advocate turning the young against their grandparents, you know, and their parents. And that tells us, I think, just how radical and extreme this libertarian cause is.
A conversation about economist James McGill Buchanan. He won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1986, and he helped lay groundwork of conservative thought that would lead all the way up to today to the so-called Freedom Caucus in Congress. We'll speak to Nancy McLean. Nancy McLean is the author of the book Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. That's next on Letters in Politics. First, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke says he is recommending that none of the 27 national monuments under review by the Trump administration be eliminated, but that changes be made to a handful. Zinke told the Associated Press that unspecified boundary adjustments for some monuments are among the recommendations he plans to make. The administration's review has alarmed public officials, Native Americans, and conservationists who worry that protections could be lost for areas that include ancient cliff dwellings, towering sequoia trees, deep canyons, and marine sanctuaries. Northern California Congressman Jared Huffman criticized the process and said there should have been congressional hearings.
This president wants to keep monuments to Confederate leaders and their rebellion against the United States, but he wants to shut down public national monuments that protect uniquely American landscapes and oceans for future generations.
Eliminating or reducing protections for the national monuments or marine sanctuaries could open them up to oil and gas drilling and other development. Donald Trump is in attack mode on Twitter today, criticizing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell for failing to win repeal of Obamacare, saying McConnell failed. He says there's such a mess because McConnell and House Speaker Paul Ryan failed to tie the debt ceiling to the popular Veterans Administration bill. Trump tweets a series of pictures of him eclipsing Barack Obama entitled "The Best Eclipse Ever." And he notes the former director of national security, James Clapper, famously got caught lying to Congress. Trump's tweets came after Clapper questioned Trump's fitness for office and said to CNN that Trump could be a national security threat.
Having some understanding of the levers that a president can exercise, I worry about, frankly, the access to nuclear codes. If he, in a fit of pique, he decides to do something about Kim Jong-un, there's actually very little to stop him.
House Speaker Paul Ryan said yesterday he did not endorse Trump's call to provoke a government shutdown if Congress fails to approve funding for the president's expanded border wall.
So I don't think anyone's interested in having a shutdown. I don't think it's in our interest to do so. While we work on doing what we actually said we would do, what we've done already in the House and we need to do, which is to control our border. So I don't think you have to choose between the two.
The National Park Service has granted a permit to a right-wing group to rally at Chrissy Field in San Francisco on Saturday. The permit to the group Patriot Prayer came over the objections of San Francisco's mayor, police chief, and other public officials. They fear violence. The National Park Service did attach a list of 26 conditions banning participants from carrying weapons or a long list of items that could be used as weapons. San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee said although he backs the restrictions, he still opposed the rally going forward.
That doesn't calm my opposition to this permit one bit, nor does it make me easy. God pray nobody gets hurt on Friday or Saturday because these people with hate-filled messages are coming in to our city to wreak havoc.
The self-styled militia group known as Oath Keepers has confirmed it will attend, purportedly to provide security to the group Patriot Prayer. The Southern Poverty Law Center describes Oath Keepers as an extremist anti-government group. A group of rabbis has canceled plans for a conference call with Donald Trump in protest of his response to Charlottesville. The Coalition of Major Rabbinical Groups says in its letter, "We have concluded that President Trump's statements during and after the tragic events in Charlottesville are so lacking in moral leadership and empathy for the victims of racial and religious hatred that we cannot organize such a call this year." The rabbi's call traditionally occurs before the Jewish high holidays. White House advisor and presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner has begun a round of talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. He's trying to kickstart negotiations. It's not clear he has anything new to bring to the table. Kushner's family foundation has helped fund West Bank settlements. I'm Eileen Alfandari. Letters and Politics is next.
And you're listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. And now joining me is Nancy McLean. Nancy McLean is the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University. And she joins us for a discussion on her new book, which is called Democracy in Chains, A Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy McLean, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you, Mitch. I'm pleased to be with you.
We've done a number of shows on the history of economics and also the history of the right. And we've talked about many different economists that were influential in the ideology of what we consider center-right or even far-right ideologies today. One name, however, we have never spoken about until today is that of James McGill Buchanan. Why do you focus on James McGill Buchanan, and who is he?
Well, first of all, let me say, in sympathy with your listeners, that I had never heard of James McGill Buchanan when I stumbled upon him in the archives pursuing another topic. And the reason that he is so important in my book is that I discovered that he essentially supplied the ideas, the style of political economy and the analysis being used by the Koch donor network today to radically transform our politics. And I think it's a story that could actually only be discovered in the past, working toward the present, precisely because Buchanan is little known outside of economics and political science and the ranks of the right. And I stumbled upon him in the late 1950s as the state of Virginia was fighting the Brown versus Board of Education public school desegregation decision and leading the South in massive resistance to that that decision. And it was at that time that Buchanan set up a center at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville to basically fight the whole model of government that had developed over the 20th century in the Progressive Era and the New Deal that essentially enabled the Brown decision to happen. So he saw it as of a piece with all of this new federal power and developed a center that was determined to push back against this intellectually. And so unlike other economists that he was associated with, and you've probably talked about, like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, he moved in that same milieu. But what he did that was distinctive was take their economic tools and turn them toward the analysis of public sector actors, elected officials, social movement leaders, etc. And he analyzed them as though they were self-interested actors, individual actors, in the same way that neoclassical economics modeled market actors. And so we can talk more about that. But basically, it was an extremely audacious at the time strategy to apply economic thought to politics like that, but it was also ideological from the start. And he actually said in later years that he wanted to, in his verb, tear down the idea of public interest that prevailed at mid-century when he set to work.
You mentioned the Koch brothers in particular. We're talking about Charles Koch here. Did he have a relationship to James Buchanan?
Yes, in fact, he did. Yes, Charles Koch has always been the more ideological of the two brothers. So my book actually says little about David because he was kind of a late add-on to the project. But Charles Koch had been deeply ideological, at least from the 1960s forward, and was constantly, you know, when he wasn't building up his company, Koch Industries, he was constantly reading in the works of advocates of what we might call free-reign capitalism or kind of Dickensian unregulated capitalism, believing that would be the path to peace and prosperity. And he funded intellectuals over decades, as he put it, looking for the right ideas, the right, as he calls it, technology that would enable a breakthrough to let him be able to create the kind of world he wanted to. And he found that in James McGill Buchanan's ideas. And beginning in the, and they met, I should say, much earlier, in, at least as early as 1970, perhaps before. Buchanan collaborated with Charles Koch on the, what became the Cato Institute. It was originally the Charles Koch Foundation, and on various and sundry other enterprises. But it was in 1997 that Charles Koch began to invest in a big way in Buchanan's center at George Mason University. And today, George Mason University is the leading academic outpost of the Koch enterprises and is a real hub for training people who go on to staff the various wings of the Koch apparatus. And I should say that now, though, that the
organizations that Koch and his donor network fund, now a number actually in the hundreds if you include the state and the international organizations as well as the purely national. So they all look separate, but they work together in an overlapping way to achieve what Koch wanted to achieve, which was, he said, at the time of that first $10 million gift to George Mason, he said he wanted to, and I quote, unleash the kind of force that propelled Columbus to his discoveries. Mm. So it's a very messianic vision. He also compared himself to Martin Luther of the Protestant Reformation.
Oh,
so this is
500th anniversary here. We're
right,
approaching the Reformation.
With a world, good point. But with a world-transforming vision, who for decades was funding various intellectuals and finally decided, hey, these are the ideas that could help us break through.
A lot to unpack here, and I want to get through a lot of it. But first, I would like you to tell us how you discovered James McGill Buchanan, and in particular, you actually got in. I mean, he died in 2013. Afterwards, mm-hmm. you actually got into his office.
I did.
I did. How did you
yes,
do that?
And it was quite breathtaking. Well, I could start. Do you want me to start with how I first found him?
Sure.
Or start with the discovery?
Whatever you think the
well,
best
I think I'll start
is.
With how yes. I first found him. So, as I said earlier, I had never heard of him when I started the research that ultimately became this book. But what had gotten my interest was the story of the state of Virginia's reaction to Brown versus Board of Education. In particular, I had happened on the story of Prince Edward County, Virginia, which completely shut down its public schools from 1959 to 1964 in the name of individual liberty and state sovereignty in opposition to the Brown decision. And they locked out all the black children from that county from formal education for 5 years, almost 2,000 children, while sending the white children off to private segregation academies with resources from those formerly public schools. And that story I had never heard of. I was embarrassed that as a historian I did not know it. I've done a lot of work on the South, but it shocked me. And I started to follow that story. And then I realized that a program of voucher, what we would today call vouchers, state-funded tuition grants, had enabled that white flight to private segregation academies. And then I discovered that Milton Friedman had issued his first manifesto for vouchers in 1955 in the full knowledge of the threats from arch segregationists to shut down public schools. So at first I was interested in following Friedman, but then I discovered this other figure, James Buchanan, who jumped into the conflict in early 1959 after there had been a mass movement of moderate white parents against the forced school closures in the fall of 1958 that locked out 13,000 white children from schools that were about to desegregate so that they couldn't desegregate. And two federal court decisions had said those closures were legal. And it was at that point that Buchanan and his colleague at this new University of Virginia Center in Charlottesville, it was at that point that they issued a report essentially making a case for privatization. The noun didn't exist then, or the verb, but privatization of Virginia's public school system, saying that it could work economically. And they made the argument in the language of economics, but their purpose was clear. They were advancing the goal of the most arch segregationists taking advantage of this crisis to move their free market fundamentalist economics program. And the phrase they used on a cover letter to one of the segregationist officials in the General Assembly said that they were doing so, in their words, quote, letting the chips fall where they may. And that phrase really lodged itself in my gut and kept me working on this and following Buchanan, trying to understand how someone with that level of advanced education and privilege could be involved in essentially abetting this project of the most arch segregationists in the language of economics. And so I kept following him. And that took me to the present. And I was following him through other archives and through his published works. And I knew that there was a collection of his papers at George Mason, but I had written a couple times and not been able to get access. And then when he died in January of 2013, I thought, okay, this is it. I have to get in here because I'd found all this other stuff. And I really, really needed to see those papers to understand fully what had happened. And so I got in. in, and it was quite a crazy time. It was actually just as Ted Cruz and others in the so-called Freedom Caucus in Congress were shutting down the federal government to get their way in the kind of hostile, coercive bargaining Buchanan long urged on corporations and right-wing foundations.
So we could draw a line from the Freedom Caucus, and we'll go through this, but we could draw a line from the Freedom Caucus all the way back to James Buchanan.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I got into this house. It was called Buchanan House, and it turned out it wasn't an archive at all. It was like a big old rambling clapboard mansion that had been his last institutional home, and there were just filing cabinets everywhere, even under the stairwells, and papers, and he did not believe in filing. And the person who had been his, as he put it, Gal Friday through the years, his leading staff assistant, she seemed not to believe in filing. And he had left many institutions in a huff. So it was just chaos. But I made my way through the first floor. And then when I got to the second floor, when I walked into his personal office, again, chaos, but I thought, well, I'll just work clockwise. And so I started with a chair that was stacked high with documents, helter-skelter. In the middle of that pile of documents, I found documentation of the Koch implant at George Mason, which had become controversial because it was using Wendy Graham, the wife of a sitting U.S. senator and a former Reagan official herself. Wendy Graham was sending out these clearly partisan fundraising appeals for this center, which a whistleblower had found and was saying, look, this stuff is illegal. And at that point, James Buchanan himself tried to disassociate from the enterprise, saying he'd been exploited by the Koch people, and it was really quite the kerfuffle. But what was fascinating for me is it took me into this world of, you know, what is sometimes called the corporate university now, of how these very arch-right donors are pushing their political agenda in universities through funding particular centers like what Koch funded at George Mason, which is now called the Mercatus Center. But anyway, getting access to Buchanan's personal papers basically confirmed all my developing understanding of what his ideas were about and what they were being used to do. So there were moments when I was in that Buchanan house where what I was finding was just heart-stopping in the way that it confirmed what I had come to believe.
Well, tell me, what was heart-stopping?
Well, there was that exchange about the Koch implant at George Mason, and how in the end it actually ran roughshod over Buchanan himself, and the university administration pushed aside its Nobel Prize winner in economics in order to please its top donor, Charles Koch. So that was pretty stunning. But I had also, along the way in my research, learned that Buchanan had been invited to Chile by the Pinochet dictatorship's civilian allies in 1980 to advise the junta on how to design a constitution that would return the country to electoral rule after this brutal dictatorship, but would do so in a way that would preserve all the gains that Chile's elite had gotten through the brutal suppression of any popular organization, you know, trade union, farmers' organization, students, etc., and privatizing Social Security, healthcare, schools, etc. And so I knew that Buchanan had gone there, but in his files I found confirmation of that, and I found correspondence with these Chilean officials. And here was Buchanan, a man who called himself a libertarian and always spoke of the free society. And so, of course, I looked for some condemnation of the dictatorship and its methods, and I found nothing of that. All I found was him applauding the regime's top newspaper, saying that they had perfectly captured his advice on the Constitution. So, of course, I quote that at length in the book, that advice that he gave, which was quite direct. But then he also thanked a top regime official for the lovely luncheon held in his honor and the jewelry and wine and flowers given to Mrs. Buchanan. And so, you know, at that point, again, something just shifted in my gut, and I thought, who am I writing about here? You know, who would be visiting and abetting one of the most brutal dictatorships of the era, whose practices actually helped give rise to global human rights activism? After all of that had been exposed in the media, they'd actually just purged universities anew before Buchanan arrived, and here he was thanking them
them for the, you know, the wine and the jewelry and the flowers for Mrs. Buchanan and the lovely lunch with no word about these repressive practices. So that was another hot heart stopper. And then there were, I would say, smaller elements along those lines. Like, for example, I found that Buchanan, before other people we know better using the term, had used the phrase counterintelligentsia, you know, something often associated with neoconservatives and such in the 1970s. But he was saying that early in the 1970s and working with Ed Meese, who was Ronald Reagan. You know, Ronald Reagan was then governor of California, and Ed Meese was his right-hand man. And Buchanan was working with him to organize such a counterintelligentsia, creating something called the Institute for Contemporary Studies and talking about, you know, creating, and these are his words, a gravy train to bring right-wing academics, you know, to learn young people into these fields, and with this gravy train get them committed to these right-wing ideas and then push them out there in the world to advocate for these ideas. So I found in his papers documentation of that, and at one point he said conspiratorial secrecy is at all times essential. I mean, this is, and he asked how much hypocrisy is necessary. So this is, you know, a kind of inside view of the building up of right-wing think tanks and right-wing bastions at universities that we don't often get access to. And then I saw how thereafter he was working with some of the top conservative or right-wing funders, you know, in addition, of course, to the Kochs, but also the SCAFE Foundation that was so important in undermining the administration of Bill Clinton in the 1990s and launching the attacks on Hillary Clinton and many other such right-wing groups, and also working with corporations and inviting CEOs and managers of corporations and right-wing foundations to Virginia to take seminars and trainings in how to apply actions on what Buchanan called the spectrum of secession. And this goes back perhaps to your interest in John C. Calhoun that you mentioned, but he advocated actions on the spectrum of secession, saying secession was no longer legal since the Civil War, but still the exit could be a threat, could be a source, the threat of exit could be a source of power and leverage. And so he urged privatization, decentralization, federalism, and a few more actions on that spectrum of secession to essentially urge corporations into what has come to be known to most of us as the race to the bottom. You know, and we tend to think of this, you know, this decline, you know, this constant corporate pressure to lower taxes, to lower public services, to say, you know, to North Carolina, well, I'm going to go to South Carolina, or to Indiana, I'm going to go to Alabama, or, you know, whatever. But, you know, basically using the threat of exit to drive down taxes, regulations, workers' rights standards, all kind, you know, environmental enforcement. And what was fascinating to me is we all talk about that as almost, you know, sort of inevitable, something that just came with globalization. But what I saw in Buchanan's papers is that he was actually training people, training corporations in how to use that threat of exit to fight democratic victories from the populations of their states on, again, matters from workers' rights to civil rights to environmental protection and so forth.
Again, we are in conversation with Nancy McLean. She is the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, and she is the author of the book that we are in conversation about. It's called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. So what did you do with James Buchanan's papers that you found at George Mason University? Did you just leave them? Did you organize them?
I made
them?
Lots of copies.
What did the university say? Was anyone upset you got them?
Well, here's an interesting thing, and I didn't understand it fully at the time, and I was actually concerned as a scholar and as a historian about the condition of these papers, because it was obvious that he was a very important man. It was obvious that this was a crucial piece of our national history, and the papers, as I said, were in utter disarray. And then I learned from someone who was working in the building that there was a threat of mold in the building. So I was really, you know, pushing and saying, you know, these really need to be preserved. They need to be put somewhere. And then it turned out that the library had tried to get Buchanan to donate his papers, but he had been resistant,
partly because he was so angry at the way the Kochs, I think, had taken over his campus and the way he had been treated shabbily by the George Mason administration in kowtowing to that to their top donor. So he was reluctant to give them over. But after after I left, they have since been taken by the Special Collections Department of the library there, which is, you know, usually university archives are in Special Collections, and they are working on processing them now. So that's interesting. And they've actually also discovered, they discovered very late in the process, another 32 boxes of his materials, which I guess were in a basement or something. I don't really know, you know, how they came to find those. But in any event, they have 32 more boxes, but they are in the course of organizing them now and processing them and making them available to researchers.
I mean, it's interesting to think. I mean, you got into his office. That's what you did. These weren't boxes put somewhere else after his death. You got into his office as it was the last time he was in there.
It was really, I mean, again, for a historian, for anybody, you know, it's important, but for a historian who's kind of mindful of the past, and I knew a lot about this guy, and it was really unsettling. You know, for example, I opened one drawer and I found a bunch of aspirin and, you know, Advil and things, and I knew he had arthritis in his later years, and he had complained about that to people in his correspondence, and so there was something just very strange about it, you know, about having access. And when there was a suit jacket of his that was still hanging on a hanger in the office. And so, again, it was unlike any archival experience that I'd had before, and it really was almost kind of haunting in the way that it was still so much a working office.
And now, they let you in? The university let you in, or did you break in?
Well, I didn't break in. I'm a good girl. I'm a nerd. Just kidding.
That's what they all say, Professor McLean.
But it's actually interesting because after Buchanan became disgusted with the way that the Koch operatives were essentially taking over his corner of the university, and he backed up from them, he said he didn't want his name to be used for anything else having to do with them, which is ironic because they just named a building after him at George Mason to launch a big fundraising drive, I was told. But in any event, he didn't want his name associated with it. He retreated into his own building and distanced himself from these operatives who all went off to this fancy new glass structure called the Mercatus Center that's housed in what is now called the Scalia School of Law, thanks to a big contribution from Charles Koch. But Buchanan didn't want to be part of that, and so he stayed in his house. And so the last person there was an editor, someone hired to edit his work. Something called the Liberty Fund was publishing a 20-volume collection of his writings. And this person had been hired as an editor, but it was kind of like last person left standing. She was also charged with kind of overseeing the house. And, you know, other researchers had come in who were associated with this Koch cause or who were Buchanan's colleagues through the years. And so anyway, she just treated me as though I were one of them and was very gracious and kind and gave me access.
Interesting. Okay, back to more of the theoretical ideas here.
Yes.
But I appreciated that because I found that fascinating. You know, writing about somebody and being able to get into their personal space is unusual, I imagine, in this field of historical work. James Buchanan won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1986. Was it for this theory called public choice theory?
It was for this theory of public choice, which again applies kind of neoclassical economic assumptions of individual, rational, self-seeking to political actors.
Is that like bringing economic theory to political theory? And explaining things.
Well, it is, but it's a particular kind of economic theory. So when he set to work, the dominant economic theory throughout the university systems in the U.S. and Western Europe was Keynesian economics after John Maynard Keynes, towering intellect who had been based at Cambridge, who understood that modern capitalist economies faced a demand problem and that because they're cyclical economies, they're prone to
recession and depression. And when that happens and people are laid off, or their wages are cut, they wouldn't have enough purchasing power to bring the economy back, you know, to stimulate demand, to have enough demand to keep the economy going. So Keynes' great genius was A, to recognize that, and B, to suggest that governments needed to engage in what he called pump priming, you know, that when the economy was weak, you would have to give it assistance with government spending. And so Buchanan set out to completely refute that idea. That was really his number one target, was that way of thinking about economics. And so that's why he applied this University of Chicago style model to political actors. And basically, it was a kind of debunking mission. He wanted to spread the belief, which we see everywhere around us today, that elected officials in particular, but also you could say, you know, trade union leaders or leaders of, you know, the AARP or other groups like this, they may talk about the common good or the public interest, but they don't really care. They're really just after their own self-interest. And in politicians' case, Buchanan would say that was in re-election. And in other cases, he would say, you know, it was the income they got from their organizations. In the case of government agency officials, which this school of thought always called bureaucrats, in turning into a kind of spit word, they would say that the agency officials were always trying to expand their fiefdoms. So the interesting thing is these ideas had no, they were all theoretical. And they all played out in game theory. Then even sympathizers early on said, this is not empirical. The greatest weakness of the school of thought is the empirical basis. They don't actually have evidence for what they're saying. But what they did do was cast aspersions on the motives of public actors in a way that the right had always done, but, you know, the extreme right. But now they were doing it with the imprimatur of science, of economic science. And what's so destructive about that can be seen today in our public life, in the language of makers and takers, right? And Buchanan even himself in his later years spoke of the productive, you know, which Republicans now will call, you know, the job creators, the productive and the predators. And he actually talked about coalitions, what did he say? Coalitions of for exploitation of the productive. So, for example, you know, we could think about this being, you know, we're approaching another anniversary year of the Memphis sanitation workers strike that Reverend Martin Luther King lost his life supporting. And that was a real coming together of the civil rights movement and of public sector workers who were being paid terribly and treated terribly and abused, both because they were black and because they were poor. Well, what King did was bring civil rights organizations together with public sector labor unions to try to improve conditions and wages and the rights of these workers. In Buchanan's terms, that would be a coalition of exploitation. His field was public finance, and he always looked at things through the lens of what were the wealthiest taxpayers being asked to give, and what if they didn't personally approve of those purposes. So as a libertarian, all he could see in, say, you know, increasing the Memphis sanitation budget in order to pay those workers fairly and provide them with shelters from the storm so that they wouldn't get killed in the trucks, as happened to three sanitation workers in what kicked off that strike. To Buchanan, that was illegitimate unless his criterion was unanimity, his desired criterion was unanimity. So unless everybody agreed to a particular public spending measure or public measure, you couldn't really say it was in the public interest or the common good. You know, you can see how this plays out, that someone like Charles Koch is never going to agree to spending monies to improve the conditions of urban schools or to, enforce anti-discrimination laws or to prevent global warming. You know, he's a leader of the fossil fuel industry. So if unanimity is your criterion, you've basically said that only the rich or that the rich get to veto everything that the majority wants to do in our political system. And I guess that takes us back to John C. Calhoun, because he also had a similar idea.
Did he then see democracy, the democratic process, as a vehicle for the mob? This is sort of like this mob to take,
yes,
from the rich? Yeah.
That is how Buchanan himself came to portray it. Yes, absolutely. And he actually said in one of his books in the mid-1970s,
that he considered his major work, the major statement of his life's program. He said in this 1975 work, you know, well, if the majority takes from people who are not willing to give, then how do you distinguish that? And he used a kind of racialized language from thug in Central Park, right? And this was in an era when Central Park, you know, when New York had a fiscal crisis and there were, you know, there was a lot of robbery, but it was, you know, he used that kind of really kind of in your face language, which is kind of rare for a scholar who typically wrote in more abstract ways. But yes, he definitely got to the point where he was portraying the vast majority of the population as sort of avaricious and engaged in calculated exploitation of rich people. And when he was in Chile, he told them that they needed a constitution that would keep others' hands out of the pockets of productive contributors. That was another phrase. And so, you know, I guess also maybe one of the things that kept me sticking with this topic, even though it meant essentially learning a new language, you know, this language that Buchanan was using and that this field uses, what kept me there is also because I am a scholar, above all, of the history, the impact of social movements on the political process. I teach courses in the history of the social movements going back to the Revolution. I've written books about, you know, a number of different social movements. And Buchanan's portrayal of his fellow citizens was so utterly at odds with what I knew about those actors and how they portrayed their own actions and how they understood what they were doing and what they were doing when they created alliances with others. It was so out of keeping with that I just, I don't know, it was almost like we're watching a car wreck or something. You know, it's just like I couldn't take my eyes away from this because I just found it so chilling. And again, you know, here's an example. I start the book with the story of a strike by black students in that county I mentioned earlier, Prince Edward County in 1951. It was a 100% solid strike by students in the high school who wanted a decent school. You know, they could see the schools that whites had. The leaders of the strike were active in every major club and the debate of society and the black version of the 4-H club and the chorus and the this, that, and the other. And so they got to tour around a little and they saw the kinds of schools that other kids had to bring them into, as they put it, the modern world. And they wanted their own school to be that. Their school had tar paper shacks. It had, you know, it was terrible. And so they had this strike to get a better school, which of course would have required more tax resources. And the county leaders actually told their parents and their principal, well, your tax contribution is too low. You know, you should earn more. And as the black leaders of Prince Edward County put it, you know, they were telling us to make bricks without straw. You know, how could we possibly pay more taxes if we didn't have the education to get better jobs? So I try to repivot in the book the civil rights movement as also a story about public finance, which was Buchanan's field, because what these young people did in Prince Edward County was, you know, they were seeing the world around them in the 1950s. They could see that the labor unions of the CIO, which were active in the South and in Virginia, were winning by applying collective power, engaging in collective bargaining. They were improving conditions for their members and their communities, and that was resulting in higher taxes for some wealthier citizens. You know, and we have a tendency, I think, only to see the civil rights struggle in terms of, you know, attitudes about race and what people have in their hearts. But this was really, you know, there's a long history of institutional racism and of public policies that favored whites in this country. And what I saw happening in that strike was that students were saying, this is not fair, this is not right, and we need to equalize it. And the consequences of that would be to have greater taxes for wealthier whites. And Buchanan saw that too in the school of thought that he founded. And I want readers to wrestle with the complexity of that, that we're not just talking about atavistic racial attitudes, but about fundamental questions of political economy and what kind of society we have been and what kind of society we want to be and what that means for things like our taxation system and our public policies.
Nancy McLean is our guest, and she is the author of the book Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy McLean, I'm going to jump around a little bit in time here, and sure. I foresee us ending or near towards the end of our conversation talking about today's Freedom Caucus. But I actually want to go back into time before we get there, back to this historical figure that you've already mentioned, John C. Calhoun, and I find John C. Calhoun interesting for a number of reasons. One, right now, because when there's so much talk nationally about the removal of Confederate statues, well, John C. Calhoun, who was a senator from South Carolina, did not live long enough to see the Civil War. But before the Civil War, he was known as the great defender of slavery in the Senate. And for me, on a personal note, I always found him fascinating because many years ago, I was a Capitol Hill correspondent, and right outside of the Senate chamber, there's this big portrait of John C. Calhoun. And knowing his history, I remember thinking to myself, I wonder if one day there's going to be pressure to remove that portrait right outside the Senate chamber. But talk to me about this connection of John C. Calhoun, and maybe you can fill in a little bit more about who he was and why it's important in understanding James Buchanan and today's right-wing politics.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll just start with an interesting fact, which is that some of Buchanan's colleagues at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, Tyler Cohen and Alexander Tabarrok, both of whom have worked with Charles Koch, well, in Cohen's case now for 25 years on this Mercatus Center and this project to change the country, they wrote a piece actually calling John C. Calhoun, it's terribly anachronistic, but they called him a precursor to modern public choice theory, to Buchanan's ideas. And then, you know, they go through the whole thing of the ways in which their ideas are similar and treating slavery as sort of an unfortunate side note, as if it wasn't central to Calhoun's motivation. But they treat slavery as a side note. And then they say that the two schools of thought, John C. Calhoun's and James Buchanan's, had the same purpose and effect. And I thought that was just fascinating. And I already knew that there was a Calhoun connection, but that took me deeper into it. So what I learned was multiple things. Well, one, and I already knew this from the earlier Virginia research that I was doing, but Calhoun was resurrected or exhumed, whatever you would call it, in Virginia in 1955 to 1956 by a right-wing columnist named James Jackson Kilpatrick, who later became nationally famous. He was exhumed so as to give Virginia respectable cover for fighting the Brown decision. So Calhoun, who actually wrote two major treatises about politics that we can come back to, and considered himself he actually used the word political science. But Calhoun had said that states had the right to interpose, was his verb, their authority between their people and the federal government when they thought that the federal government was in error. So that's why Kilpatrick revived Calhoun's ideas, and the state of Virginia and a number of others actually adopted what were called interposition resolutions in answer to the Brown versus Board mandate to desegregate. And so Calhoun was very much in the air when Buchanan moved to Virginia. And James Jackson Kilpatrick was the news editor of one of Virginia's major dailies. He was constantly, you know, he said he was riding a steed and the pen was his lance. And he was writing all the time about Calhoun. And it was, you know, a big subject. And at the University of Virginia, the president, Colgate Darden, was also part of a group called the Virginia Commission on Constitutional Government, which was, again, using these ideas to push back on the New Deal model of government, saying that the federal government didn't have any right, constitutional right, to regulate the states. So that stuff was very much in the air as Buchanan was developing his constitutional theories, even in the air at his own university. So part of what I was doing, too, is providing that context, that historical context for the development of his ideas, because, you know, other people in his fields don't know about that. It's been quite a shock for them to hear it, but it's true. And I think a lot of people, he often talked about the minority, right? And so if you were reading his book, you know, say at Yale or the University of Minnesota or University of California, you might read him talking about the rights of the minority and think he's talking about, you know, embattled racial minorities in the South or political dissenters. But I could see he did nothing to help embattled racial minorities. If anything, he was, you know, tightening the oppressive measures they were facing. And he many times called for repression of
political dissenters and activists and organizers, so clearly he wasn't interested in them. When he talked about the minority, he was really talking about the rich. And that's what links him to Calhoun. Because again, I think we have sometimes a way of talking about race in contemporary America that makes racism sort of like just a disease of the heart, you know, or an irrational attitude. But what we see in Calhoun is a cold-eyed calculation about how best to protect a wealth-generating system that was at the forefront of the capitalism of its day. There were more millionaires in Mississippi than in New York when Calhoun was writing. And they were rich because of the system of slavery. But Calhoun could see that a national democracy was getting more and more hostile to slavery, or to slaveholders, if not to slavery. There was more and more dissent. You know, the abolitionists were organizing. A lot of things were happening. And so Calhoun's concern was to defend that system, to erect barriers for that economic system to the reach of national democratic political majorities. And so that's really the crucial link that I see with Buchanan's project and with Koch's project, because in all three cases, you had individuals who could see that their ideas would never be embraced by a minority, by a majority. These were men who had an extreme, you know, whatever you want to call it, free reign capitalism ideal. And they could see that the majority would never agree with those ideas. And in each case, repeated experience had shown that. And so what they began to do was develop ideas for how to shackle, in the phrase that I use in the book, how to shackle these democratic majorities with various measures. And in Calhoun's case, that was the notion of states' rights and interposition. And ultimately, in the case of the slaveholding South, you know, war against the federal government, treason to get away from that democratic majority. So that's the case with Calhoun, but also with Buchanan and Koch. They more and more push for measures that would atomize the majority. So trying to destroy labor unions without actually being honest that that's what you're doing, but that's clearly what you're doing. Trying to undermine Social Security as a system of social insurance and push toward privatization in individual accounts, but without telling the public that's what you're doing. And I have in the book a whole kind of chilling discussion about the advice Buchanan gave to Charles Koch's Cato Institute in the 1980s about how to undermine Social Security without saying that's what you were going to do. And so that's why I talk about, you know, sort of the stealth agenda.
So how'd they do that?
So Buchanan, and it's really an interesting thing. I mean, he basically says, you know, and he goes through the constituencies. He says there is no group in America that wants to see radical change to Social Security. He says neither the rich nor the poor, nor the black, the white, the brown or the white, men or women, Rust Belt or Sun Belt. I mean, he really goes through all. He said no support. Therefore, he says, if you want to undermine Social Security, if you want to, you know, get rid of this system, which libertarians had always hated, and go to private accounts, here's what you need to do. And he went through step by step, and I described that in the book. But first he said you have to create doubt about the system's viability, right, and say it's not going to be there for you, you can't rely on it, etc. And there have been, you know, millionaire and billionaire funded efforts to do that ever since, to, you know, run these ads to make people think the system won't be there for them. Then he advocated a system of divide and rule, dividing, you know, kind of classic divide and conquer, but in his terms, like informed by his public choice thought, that paid attention to the salience of issues. So he said, first thing to do is to reassure those who are currently receiving Social Security benefits or about to that their benefits will not.
That's right.
Yeah. And he said, and he talked about it as buying them off. And because, as a, you know, doing this public choice stuff, he realized that they would be the ones who would pay the most attention to the system because they were, you know, they really needed it. So get them out of the struggle, he said. Then you're, you know, it's much easier. Then you have these other groups that you could turn against one another. And it's just really chilling. He says, you know, you can do this to agitate the wealthy taxpayers. Then he also talked about trying to break off younger people. And it effectively, he urged, and the right has since incited, a kind of generational class warfare to tell younger people that they're providing a tremendous welfare subsidy, was the phrase, for the aged. You know, and tell me any conservative anywhere in the world that would advocate turning the young against their grandparents, you know, and their parents. And that tells us, I think, just how radical and extreme this libertarian cause is, even though it's found that to succeed politically, it makes more sense to embrace the conservative mantle because there are only like 3% libertarians in this country, so they can't sail under their own name. So they've made a lot of compromises to get with the larger group of conservative voters. But it's really chilling stuff. There were a lot of times when I was doing the research for this book where I just quite literally felt nausea, you know, or I'd start to get a headache because I would see, first of all, the duplicity of things like that. So that approach to Social Security, or today we could say similar things happening with immigration and other issues, the Racial Justice Act in North Carolina. But, so I would see the duplicity, but I also saw the scale of these operations. And when I would start finding different people who are connected to different parts of the operation, looking them up on the web and seeing, you know, staff sometimes of like 100 people, you know, and my heart would just sink, you know, because I would just think, you know, Americans, we don't, just don't know what this train is that's coming at us. This is so calculated and so strategic and so well funded. And these guys think they've gotten very close to success. Oh, and I forgot one other crucial thing about how they expect to lock this in. And Buchanan, in addition to winning the Nobel Prize for his public choice analysis, also won it for his thinking about what they called the economic constitution. And basically, Buchanan has advocated a constitutional revolution. That was his phrase. He said no existing constitution adequately protected the minority from the majority. And again, here you have to read the economic minority of the wealthy. Wealthiest and most extreme right taxpayers.
Okay.
And so he started prescribing particular things that you could do with the Constitution to, again, shackle the majority will. And lo and behold, Charles Koch, since the 1970s, has been investing more and more in his donor network in transforming our country's law schools, in training sitting federal judges. At one point in the early 1990s, 2 out of 5 federal judges had gone through a program at run by Buchanan's colleague at George Mason. Henry Manny was his name. They called it Henry Manny Camp, and they'd take these federal justices on these luxury junkets, you know, and train them in this law and economics thought. But anyway, training federal justices, funding litigation organizations like the Institute for Justice, it's called, that wants to go back to a pre-New Deal constitution. And now they are pushing for constitutional conventions. So I know you're in California, you know, out there in the free world, but I live in North Carolina, which is one of the 25 states wholly controlled, or now we're not. We have the Democratic governor, but until 2016, wholly controlled by the Republican Party, meaning both houses of the legislature and the governorship. And in these red controlled states, they've been organizing for a constitutional convention. And by some counts, they now have 28 of the 34 states needed to call a constitutional convention. Now, most Americans, what does that mean? You know, so what? Well, the thing is, we have not had a constitutional
convention. Well, once we have a constitutional convention, everything's on the table.
Exactly. We've not had one since 1787 when the constitution we have was created, and the delegates who went there did something other than what they were asked to do.
It would be like creating a second republic.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is exactly what Charles Koch and this donor network wants to do. And they tell the public these anodyne phrases about how they're pro-growth and limited government and so forth and so on. But they are pushing toward this hard right reconstruction of our government. And because they are so wealthy and are so able to staff, you know, what Buchanan called that gravy train with operatives in these different organizations, they are coming stunningly close to being able to transform our system of governance. So it's really something I think that people need to start paying attention to. And I will say my concern, you know, as somebody who's studied this building up, you know, over 10 years now, my concern is with the Trump presidency, that the president is, you know, such a wild card, con man, you know, whatever, that people are distracted by his daily tweets and his antics and the Russia investigation, and we're not really watching the radical policy changes being pushed through at the federal level and in the states in this Trump era. And that's a real danger, because by some researchers' count, 70% of Trump's top senior appointees come from the Koch donor network, and they are pushing through radical changes in front after front, agency after agency.
At the state level?
Again, well, this is happening at the state level because barely anybody's reporting on the states anymore, you know, because we've lost so many people don't subscribe to newspapers now. And it's kind of like if a tree falls in the forest, do people hear it? So there's not enough reporting on the state level. But even in Washington, the Trump administration is pushing through radical changes on many different fronts. I mean, the Labor Department is a disaster. There's people who don't believe at all in workers' rights who are shredding various kinds of regulations to protect workers' rights and their health and safety. The environmental EPA is transformed, and a recent article in the New York Times talked about the bizarre level of secrecy that no one had ever seen before, and you couldn't get, you know, you have to have a fob to get around through offices that used to be open. Well, meanwhile, they're taking counsel from the fossil fuel industry on how to, you know, essentially undercut regulations built up over years. Vice President Mike Pence has come from the Koch network, the director of the budget, Mick Mulvaney, Trump's liaison to Congress, the White House liaison to Congress, Mark Short, comes from Freedom Partners. It's just an agenda designed by these right-wing billionaires and millionaires is moving through so quickly under Trump. And again, while most of us are in a state of distraction.
We're down to our last minute, but I did want to add, Trump himself, even though he may have surrounded himself with these people, mm-hmm. which is important, but himself is not necessarily a part of this club. The Koch brothers did not support his presidency.
Yeah, Donald Trump seems to be about Donald Trump and not much else. But I will say Donald Trump is a real social Darwinist. You know, all his talk about genes and who's better than whom and who's losers, that kind of social Darwinism has long been associated with libertarians. Even, in fact, when I was in Buchanan's office, I found a classic social Darwinist text right out on his desk by William Graham Sumner. Mm. But so I think Trump is actually drinks in this water more than people realize. And he said many things on the campaign trail to try to attract voters of lesser means, in addition to all the agitation to racism and whatnot that he also put out there. But in office, he's not delivering on a lot of those things that he put out there to lure people. And he is very quickly moving through this agenda. For example, he criticized Wall Street and, you know, corporate money and the Koch, other politicians as being Koch puppets, and yet he's staffed his administration with people from Goldman Sachs and other parts of Wall Street, and it's probably the most the wealthiest cabinet, I believe, has been reported that we've ever had, with more people from corporations who make claims on government.
Nancy McLean, this has been a fascinating conversation, yet we are out of time. Nonetheless, I do thank you greatly.
I thank you, too.
Again, Nancy McLean has been our guest. She is the author of the book that we have been in conversation about. It's called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. And that does it for Letters in Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is the engineer. You can find our archives at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, San Francisco.
time of useful consciousness. The first nuclear chain reaction, Enrico Fermi and Henry Moore. The Italian physicist Enrico Fermi set off the first nuclear chain reaction in an underground rackets court at the University of Chicago. His experiment led directly to the building of the plutonium bomb that destroyed the city of Nagasaki. In retrospect, it seems unfathomable that anybody would have conducted such a dangerous experiment in the middle of a crowded city. The University of Chicago in the early 60s decided to commemorate the Fermi experiment in order to claim that the birth of the atomic age happened on their grounds on December 2, 1942, at 3:30 in the afternoon. The historian McNeil negotiated with the most famous outdoor sculptor of that time, Henry Moore, whose 12-foot bronze sculpture sits on that site today. Compared to a giant Darth Vader mask, the sculpture appears to be a combination of a skull and an atomic mushroom cloud. It stands in strange contrast to the commemorative plaque next to it that praises, quote, the controlled release of nuclear energy. And the tension between these two views of history is one topic of today's broadcast. In part one of this program, you heard a description of the Fermi experiment. The 27-foot-high atomic pile of graphite and uranium in the shape of a beehive, and the crescendo of the Geiger counters as the unshielded pile went critical. In the report on the successful experiment, Fermi was given the code name, the Italian Navigator, a.k.a. Columbus. Ian Ball, historian of technology and the writer of this account, points to the historic decision taken immediately after the experiment to build not just the bombs for Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but to begin mass production of nuclear weapons. The mile-long building of the Piketon Uranium Enrichment Plant and the Hanford Reactor, a testimony to that effort. Ian Ball.
When Fermi's experiment was successful, they immediately decided to scale up the reactor a billion times in order to produce plutonium. Remember that the job of the Fermi reactor was to produce plutonium, which would then make the bomb that came to be dropped on Nagasaki. Hiroshima was a uranium bomb. The Nagasaki bomb was a plutonium bomb. Hanford was not in the business of nuclear power, certainly not. In fact, the heat, as you know from Fermi's remarks about his own pile in Chicago, the heat was a completely unwanted byproduct. And not only that, but of course the warming and the poisoning of the Columbia was and remains an ecological disaster. Now, if the Italian Navigator was confident that he could prevent a catastrophic meltdown, he was also pretty confident, it seems, about the risk of low-level radioactivity. I found literally back-of-the-envelope calculations done in the archives there about dosages and so on. The atomic pile itself was completely without shielding, except, incidentally, some pine scaffolding. And in fact, the site was still hot when it was excavated, and we know this from the architect, when it was excavated in 67 in preparation for the installation of Atom Peace. For Atom Peace was the name that Henry Moore gave to the sculpture. A lot of his sculptures were called something Peace, Locking Peace, P-I-E-C-E. But Atom Peace, interesting. Fermi did not live to see the unveiling of Atom Peace, did not live to see the 25th anniversary celebrations. He died of leukemia in 1954. A year after the Chicago delegation arrived, Moore is being pressed to show them something more than just the maquette that the delegation had seen. And by February, Moore was able to send photographs of the 4-foot working model. And the arrival of these prints in Chicago caused a storm. And that's not surprising. And in fact, it put the whole project in crisis, particularly as the funding had still not yet been secured. Now, McNeil didn't communicate any of this to Moore. Moore presumably knew that that this Darth Vader stormtrooper helmet, mushroom cloud, dark, monstrous object would surely, you know, not go through on the nod. McNeil, however, the great humanist, pulled some stock phrases from the brand tub of humanists, and he used phrases like intriguing, impressive, rich bafflement, genuine yearning, awful majesty, that kind of stuff. The scientists said they knew what they saw. And Samuel Allison, who'd been in charge of building the exponential piles back in 1942, and whose voice it was that counted down to zero at the Trinity test in the desert of New Mexico, he saw the photograph, and this is a quote, was strongly opposed. "I am strongly opposed to placing the statue on the site of Stagg Field. It would be more appropriate for such a statue to be located either at Alamogordo or Hiroshima." However, McNeil was powerful, and George Beadle, the president, was on his side, and he pushed it through. Interestingly, they had to still, McNeil's compromise was to think of ways to blunt the criticism of atom peace that was circulating around the campus. And he came up with an interesting plan. The decision was to ask Henry Moore if it would be all right if they renamed the sculpture Nuclear Energy, which would align it to the phrase on the plaque, the release of nuclear energy. The punning resonance between atom peace and atom peace was, McNeil said much later, too close to be comfortable. And that we don't know exactly how it happened, but Moore in the end said, okay. He was sort of sandbagged at a lunch when he went to visit the site, and he said sort of, okay. He went along with it. It's interesting, if you look at the archives, Moore in the English archives, all the files are still called Atom Peace, that no concession is made to the title Nuclear Energy in the English files. And Moore himself always continued to call it Atom Peace. So it's shipped to Chicago via the Great Lakes, and it docks in Chicago in time for the 25th anniversary event. It's now December 1967, 4 years after the delegation arrives, just after Kennedy's assassination, just before Christmas 1963 in England. When they got to Henry Moore first in December 63, remember, this is just after the signing of the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty. And the first wave of anti-nuclearism in Britain has sort of just broken, partly because the Cuban Missile Crisis has been resolved and people feel that, well, maybe we can handle a nuclear world by diplomacy, however much brinkmanship there was. It's just 7 weeks before the Tet Offensive, which really marks the opening of 68, a year of insurrectionary unrest in America's cities, met, of course, by massive state violence, not least from the Chicago police at the Democratic Party convention. I would think that just a few weeks later, and there would have been a far less restrained protest that greeted the pantheon of atomic scientists and bureaucrats who came to the whole event which surrounded Henry Moore's, the unveiling of the Moore statue was embedded in a much larger sort of atom fest. Still, they imagine a world of, you know, thousands of nuclear power stations, the atomic establishment. This is still pre, of course, Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and so on. So there were 2 days of intense propaganda and international diplomacy, orchestrated by the university, the Atomic Energy Commission, the American Nuclear Society, and others. You know, six Nobel scientists, a whole slew of people, number of the original scientists who still survived from the 42 experiment. And Moore himself was, in a sense, a guest at the court of the nuclear establishment. But the barons of the military scientific complex did not quite have the stage to themselves. Looking in the in the journalistic record here, I found an interesting photograph which shows that there was a huge banner dripping crimson, reading in capital letters, Peace, P-E-A-C-E, hung from the roof of the laboratory, which stood on the west side of Ellis Street. This is the Fermi lab. And unreported in the official press coverage, Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, picketed the crowd with leaflets. And there's an interesting description by Richard Stern, the novelist. And he says this: the president of the University of Chicago, the widow of Enrico Fermi, that's Laura, and the sculptor Henry Moore, yanked at the tarpaulin which draped the massive coppery bronze which marked the 25th anniversary of Fermi's baptismal announcement of the atomic age. The reaction is self-sustaining, the curve is exponential. The commemorative scene might have been staged by Fellini. The guests sat under a peppermint awning. The wind threatened the ropes and flags. The Farragut High School band squirted out Sousa marches. A little way off, cranes and earth movers stopped trenching the old football field for the piers of the new university library. So Stern then listened that day to old men reminiscing about the events of 42. And he concluded, since then, almost everything had changed. The squash rackets court, no bigger than one sculptor's workshop, had become Oak Ridge. Chicago pile number one had led to mass murder. How was this all received? Once again, reviewers and critics of the unveiled sculpture reached for the same tropes. Moore's artwork was said to symbolize the ambiguity of the atomic age. And of course, as you know, this is a classic example of the liberal doctrine of technology as neutral instrument. Good uses, bad uses. When McNeil presses him 2 years earlier, he'd already sort of said explicitly what he thought it was. Quote, the upper part is connected with the mushroom cloud of a nuclear explosion. But also it has the shape and eye sockets of a skull. The story you'll get when you go to the Moore Foundation and the Keepers of the Flame talk to you about this sculpture. They say that, yes, indeed, it's a skull. And that one particular bone informed Atom Peace, namely an elephant skull, that Moore first saw in the Hampstead Garden of his old friends, the Huxleys. This is Sir Julian Huxley, the famous biologist, and his wife, Juliet. In the early 60s, the Huxleys had gone to East Africa, and they were staying at the Mount Kenya Club. In an exchange for a promise by the Huxleys to raise the poaching crisis, which was a problem, the American owner, on learning that Juliet Huxley had always coveted an elephant skull, said, you shall have one. Tomorrow, we have to shoot a rogue elephant, and I'll send you the skull. And for several years, the skull sat growing moss, and a wren's nest was in it too, on a rotating base in the Huxley's garden in London. And Juliet Huxley had known that Henry Moore, on one of his regular visits to the Huxleys, had been galvanized by the sight of this massive skull during the time of in that four-year period of the Atom Peace Commission. And on a later visit, she told Moore that she'd like him to have the elephant skull. And it now dominates Henry Moore's studio. Now, here's where it gets fascinating. In October 1970, that's to say 3 years after the unveiling, Moore staged, anachronistically, a series of photographs of himself at work on the maquette, which he still had, the plaster cast of Atom Peace. Going into Errol Jackson's archive, the photographer, I found the following notation. Moore asked me to make some portraits of him at work, putting finishing touches to the Atom Peace maquette. The elephant skull was to be in the background, as it was the original inspiration for the Atom Peace. So here we have a photo session which is obviously intended retroactively to fix the connection, but there's a problem. Moore could not possibly have seen the elephant skull before he made the original maquette shown to the Chicago boys when they came in December, for the simple reason that the skull did not reach London before the spring of 1964. What are we to make of Moore's retroactive staging of this impossible inspiration? Let's ask ourselves about the images and visual tropes that might have occurred, that would have occurred, I think, to a sculptor embarking on such a commission to commemorate nuclear energy. For more, the CND symbol, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, of which he, of course, as I've mentioned earlier, was the founder member. To free associate on the words atomic, nuclear, in 1963 in England would be almost certainly to conjure up a CND banner and its black and white mandala, which had been invented in that form by a conscientious objector who'd worked on a farm in Norfolk in the Second World War, a man called Gerald Holtom. He'd been approached by the Direct Action Committee Against Nuclear War, which preceded, which was a small radical cell within what later became the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And when they planned their first four-day march from London to the bomb-making factory in England, the Weapons Research Establishment at Aldermaston, for Easter 1958, they'd gone to Gerald Holton to coordinate the sort of design of a sort of what we would now call a logo. And he invented a nuclear disarmament symbol for use with all the banners and slogans. What he came up with is interesting, and his own account is also interesting. He just said, "I drew myself, the representative of an individual in despair, with hands palm outstretched outwards and downwards in the manner of Goya's peasant before the firing squad. I formalized the drawing into a line and put a circle around it." Two other motifs dominated the iconography of the British anti-nuclear movement, at the heart of which was Henry Moore himself. Don't forget. And these motifs were powerfully deployed by another graphic artist, a man, a German refugee called F.H.K. Henrion. He used collage techniques, and he came up with the canonical CND poster design. What was it? It's a collage of a human skull and a mushroom cloud. Atom peace, so I want to say, is a condensation of the two central motifs of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, the death's head and the mushroom cloud, that Moore publicly admitted that he had seen there. The anachronistic restaging seems to aim, 3 years later, at naturalizing a highly charged political symbol. Conversely, I take it that Moore's sculpture, as much as it's a condensation of the two motifs of cloud and skull, is, if you like, a decondensation, is a reverse, an inverse of that. It's a decondensation of the CND mandala, which you can put in correspondence with the sculpture. Basically, a tripodal figure inscribed in a circle, materialized by Moore as a skull resting on a three-legged base of animal sacrifice. The tripod is the sign in the classical world of animal sacrifice. So here's my conclusion. Henry Farmer, Henry Moore, scientist and artist, men with grand designs, each needing hefty patronage to scale up their models, negotiating the means essential to the realization of their projects. In the case of Fermi, the unlimited emergency powers of the secret military-industrial state were mobilized to scale up his benchtop maquettes, his lattices of uranium and graphite. In Moore's case, old Chicago money, accruing from Prairie and Slaughterhouse to the Ferguson Fund, quote, for civic art on public land, was diverted by special arrangement to a private site, because in fact this Chicago site is on private land, so that his 6-inch plaster model of atom peace could take 12-foot bronze form in front of the Fermi Institute for Nuclear Studies. I wonder, actually, if it ever crossed Moore's mind in the context of this commission, that a great deal of his own wealth was already derived at just one remove from the nuclear industry. His friend, he became a friend, and his biggest collector, Joe Hirshhorn, many of you will have been to the Hirshhorn Museum in D.C., that Hirshhorn himself had made his own vast fortune from the Blind River uranium deposits in Canada. Another was the public health disaster, an epidemic of lung cancer, caused by the exposure of uranium miners to the radioactive daughters of radon gas. U.S. bomb production in the Cold War and since, driven at a furious pace by the Atomic Energy Commission, negligent, very negligent, of workers' health, has probably cost the lives of thousands of American, Canadian, and especially Native American miners. And, of course, the disaster of Blind River and the nuclear complex is not over. To the question, where did Fermi's experiment end, there is no answer. For one thing, the half-lives of these elements must be measured in thousands of years. The deliberate release of nuclear energy, quote, mostly on the lands of indigenous peoples, has created poisoned landscapes around the globe. About 2,000 tests were conducted in the first 50 years of the atomic age, an average of one nuclear explosion every 9 days. And across the colonial spaces of Central Asia, of Algeria, Australia, the Pacific, India, and the intramontane west of the United States, the legacy of Fermi and the weaponeers now stretches, an immense geography of sacrifice. And finally, what sort of work does Moore's Atom Piece perform today, sitting on the old site of Chicago Pile No. 1? For one thing, it speaks back to the inscription, to that plaque, to its beautifully restrained and well-worded mendacity. On December the 2nd, 1942, man achieved here the first self-sustaining chain reaction and thereby initiated the controlled release of nuclear energy. It continues to embarrass the university, in fact, and the nuclear establishment. It's actually proven quite unassimilable to their project. It's not become a site of world historic pilgrimage, no. The crouched embryo, which McNeil tried to read there, that's, he continued for years to see a crouched embryo in there. That's to say, something that would figure the birth of the atomic age in Chicago against the claims of Alamogordo and Hiroshima, was a private fantasy. On the other hand, Moore's sculpture keeps attention focused on the high centers of scientific reason, of containment, and away from the distant zones of sacrifice. This inability of Atom Piece to achieve a stable reading might have been illuminating to the administration of the United States Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, when in the same year as it was moved in Hiroshima, 1991, it commissioned a panel of specialists, material scientists, architects, artists, others, to design a sculpture that would sit on top of the U.S. government's proposed permanent nuclear waste repository. The remit of the panel was to produce it, in other words, to do something which Henry Moore had been trying to do, perhaps, or others were, you know, this was going to be the sculpture that would do the job. That it would be a design that would be legible, and this was the remit, by inhabitants of the American West 10,000 years from now. The result was one of the stranger government documents, a report entitled, and I quote, "Expert Judgment on Markers to Deter Inadvertent Human Intrusion into the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant." One suggestion was a plaque. A plaque reading, "Danger. Poisonous radioactive waste buried here. Do not dig until AD 12,000. The linguist on the panel had to point out that no language, let alone civilization, had ever lasted 10,000 years. No plaque could possibly pass the longevity test. Other proposals included, quote, "the landscape of thorns, 1 square mile of randomly spaced basalt spikes, 80 feet high, erupting from the ground." Another, "the black hole, a vast pad of black concrete that would absorb so much heat it would be impossible to get near it." The menacing earthworks, as if somehow by saying menacing, you know, it's going to do the job. "A large empty square surrounded by 50-foot-high earthen berms jolting outwards." Perhaps the most intriguing idea was not sculptural at all, but the endowment of a nuclear priesthood that would pass the taboo down the generations by word of mouth. No mention was made of the fact that the world's first official nuclear waste site, where the remains of CP1, Chicago Pile No. 1, are buried, a place called Plot M in the Palos Forest Preserve outside Chicago, again also quite close to O'Hare, uncannily rehearses the proposed EPA marker. I've been there. It's an interesting place. A dressed granite cube lying in the middle of a grassy clearing bears the mildly worded provocation, caution, do not dig. At the Chicago site itself, and here's where I end, what endures is the force field generated between plaque and monument, a contradiction that could not be resolved by linguistic fiat, despite Moore permitting, of course, his American commissioners to retitle the sculpture once it was in situ nuclear energy. Henry Moore himself, of course, declined to speak that day in 1967. The stage belonged to Glenn Seaborg and other atomic salesmen to make kitsch scientific claims about clean, safe, limitless power. Meanwhile, we are living in the immensely long shadow of Fermi's experiment, and atom piece, skull on blasted tripod, stands testimony to that sacrifice. Thank you.
This was part two of a two-part story on Enrico Fermi and the beginning of the nuclear age from the timeless archives of TUC Radio. You heard a chapter from the upcoming book, The Long Theft, by the Irish historian of technology, Ian Bull, recorded in March 2002 at a series of events where scientists and historians met with a small circle of friends. They gave previews of projects that had not yet appeared in any public space. In the same venue, Ian Bull had earlier given an intriguing view of the 19th century Luddites. That's also a TUC radio program. He is co-editor of Resisting the Virtual Life and author of the 2011 history of the bicycle entitled The Green Machine. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Alienable rights, the exclusion of African Americans in a white man's land, 1619 to 2000, is a book written by Professor Barry Sanders of Pitzer College from the Claremont Colleges and Francis D. Adams, an independent scholar living in Los Angeles, California. Sanders and Adams maintain that the drive for equal rights for black people in the United States has never had the support of the majority of Americans. Racial progress has been made in brief historical bursts when a committed militant minority of abolitionists, radical Republicans, and civil rights activists stirred the nation and pressured it into change. In this program, we visit with Dr. Francis D. Adams and begin when I asked him to explain the importance of the trial of James Somerset that took place in England in 1772.
Somerset was a slave to a Virginia slaveholder. He had come with him to England, and he had escaped from his owner in England and was recovered finally. And the suit developed over whether he was a free man having come to England or whether he remained a slave. Lord Mansfield was the Chief Justice of the King's Bench, who oversaw the case and finally reached a decision in relation to it. And he said that Somerset was a free man having set foot in England, that there was no such thing as a slave in England, he said, that the only way you could have slavery in England if there had been positive law, in other words, if there were some sort of legal situation that had created men as slaves, otherwise custom or usage were not sufficient to do that. This meant that about 14,000 black men who were in England were suddenly free, and the question arises, of course, if England had freed its slaves, didn't that control the situation in the colonies? Wouldn't the slaves have been free at that point?
Well, that created a fork in the road that appears not to have been followed, at least in North America.
Yeah, that's perfectly right. What had happened really was that England over the years had given the colonies a good deal of freedom to run things however they wanted to. And in all of its colonies, particularly in North America, the colonies had individually developed their own systems of slavery quite apart from English law. And they had laws that were essentially their own and that were not necessarily consistent from one colony to another.
It's interesting to note that England gave its colonies significant freedom and latitude in making its own rules, but Spain chose not to do that in Central and South America. Why was that?
Well, that's perfectly true. One of the main reasons was the English wanted to didn't want to spend the money it would have cost to control the colonies, and instead they, in the southern colonies at least, where slavery was strong, they relied on enterprising men who were willing to spend their own money to develop the colonies, and they really only retained control over trade and things like war, for example. If the colonies or the or Britain itself had gone to war, they would expect some contribution from the colonies.
The control over trade was somewhat influenced, I would expect, by allowing the colonies to proceed with slavery so that there would be a labor force for the markets that would come and the products that would come from the colonies.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, it relieved the question for Britain of whether they approved of slavery or not, really, because the colonies then were able to do whatever they wanted to do, and the British could say, well, we aren't really responsible for any of that.
So why was the Somerset decision not followed in the colonies?
Well, it wasn't followed in the colonies because it simply, you know, didn't fit what existed in the colonies. By 1772, there were hundreds of thousands of slaves throughout the South, and the colonial leaders certainly had no desire to surrender what was the mainstay of the southern economy.
So therefore, from a de facto or functional sense, the Somerset decision had no effect in the colonies and in North America.
Yeah, really had very little effect. I mean, you know, people talked about it, and of course, people around the world and abolitionists or people who believed in abolition in North America pointed to it as an example of what should be done in the colonies, but it had no direct effect, really, on anyone.
So if we step ahead a number of years and look at the founding fathers, the people who wrote down the words that became the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, what they did at home was somewhat different than what they wrote into the Declaration and the Constitution.
It certainly was, particularly among Southern members of the Founding Fathers who were significant slaveholders. I mean, Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, was the primary writer, at least, was a significant slaveholder, as was Washington, Madison, all these men from the South, others whose names we don't know quite so well, but were also members of the Constitutional Convention, men like Randolph and the Pinckneys, that they were all slaveholders at home and maintained large plantations.
Do you think there was a conscious duplicity in their thinking, or was this just the way it was, and from their point of view, God willed it as that?
Yeah, well, no, I don't think it was duplicity at all. I mean, I think they had faith in the life they had constructed for themselves in the New World, and, they rationalized it in a number of different ways. One of the things that many of them argued was that the Bible supported slavery, that it was something that existed throughout the world, and that it was a matter of really dealing with an inferior people who were probably better off as slaves than they had been in Africa.
Well, that's one thesis that has been presented on this program, that the Puritan interpretation that people of color were an inferior group actually affected the thinking and the development in terms of a progression toward equality to a greater extent than did the Southern slaveholders' economic interest. Do you find any support for that?
Well, it's certainly true. I think of it as, two great forces that gave the colonists sense of themselves as a chosen people. On the one hand, in New England, you have Puritanism. With it goes a belief, after all, that the Puritans were a chosen people who were going to purify the church. They had been given this paradisical new continent in which to create a kind of new Jerusalem. And consequently, they were chosen by God. That made them better than everyone else in the world. Therefore, they had a sense of inferiority about many people, and particularly about blacks. Cotton Mather, for example, kept house slaves, and he treated them well, educated them, something that slaveholders in the South wouldn't do. He also writes about, in his household, having to be on guard all the time because it was known by everyone that blacks were naturally thievish. There was a second kind of superiority, too, that probably was stronger in the South, and that was the belief that the men who came to North America were carrying on the tradition of the Anglo-Saxons, and that they themselves were a continuation of the Anglo-Saxon race. And in continental history, the Anglo-Saxons were viewed as a pure race who had never been adulterated by mixing with anyone else. They were a powerful moral race who had lived an almost idyllic life on the continent. And Jefferson, as a matter of fact, when he argued for the right of the colonies to break away from England, he did it on the basis of the fact that they were a continuation of Anglo-Saxons. And as Anglo-Saxons, they weren't governed by laws that the English crown had constructed to govern the Normans who had invaded England. Those were feudal laws that meant that the king essentially owned all the land and granted it to his vassals. In the case of the Anglo-Saxons, they maintained that the land was theirs by conquest and that the king never owned the land, that whatever fealty they gave to the king was based on their willingness to do it. And so if the Southerners, Jefferson in particular, was a great fan of the Anglo-Saxons, and they believed simply that they were chosen people, again, of a different type, but certainly they were superior to the inferior African-American or black.
When we take a look at the founding documents of the United States, again, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, there's a schism as to the rights of black people. C- Can you discuss the origin of that?
Well, in the Declaration of Independence, it says that all men are endowed with inalienable rights, which means they have rights that they are given, that they are born with, and that come directly from God, and that all men share those rights. And that was the assertion made in the Declaration of Independence. And it was a fine statement in relation to Great Britain and separating yourself from the English, because what it said was the colonists had a right to break away from England if they wanted to, because freedom was a right that was given to all men by God. By the time you got to the Constitution, freedom was no longer the issue, if you will.
Yet before they got to the Constitution, and even before the Declaration of Independence in 1776, we have the Somerset decision.
Yeah, except the Somerset decision had very little to do with the North American continent. None of the colonies took the Somerset decision so seriously that they acted on it.
Proceeding with the Constitution and the development of the Constitution.
The Constitutional Convention opened with a need to make the government a stronger government. The Articles of Confederation, under which the colonies operated since the time of the Revolution, there was no real central control in it. There was no powerful central government. It allowed each colony an equal vote in any decision the Confederation was going to reach. And what that meant was that any colony could, in effect, veto any action by the whole 13 colonies or the Confederation. What they found was that they were really unable to function very well internationally. They didn't have a single currency. There were a number of things that made them very difficult for them to simply function as a nation. And as a matter of fact, Alexander Hamilton said just that they would be weak and powerless until the point at which they formed a strong central government. And that was really the point of the Constitutional Convention, to try to bring together the 13 colonies and create a single nation that had a stronger central government.
Let's talk about the development and the effects of the Constitutional Convention on African Americans in the United States. But first, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Professor Francis D. Adams, an independent scholar who lives in Southern California, who, with Professor Barry Sanders, is the author of Alienable Rights, The Exclusion of African Americans in a White Man's Land, 1690 through 2000. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Francis Adams, the development of the Constitution ignored the fact that all men are created equal, and in fact didn't even mention women.
Didn't mention slaves, as a matter of fact. Never would use the term in the document. Said they called them people serving others, or just referred to them simply as people, but the word slave never appeared. The reason for that, most people think, is that they were really embarrassed in a way about the situation and didn't want to include the existence of slavery in the National Constitution.
I think it also had to do with the economics of the time and the labor force in the South that was a non-industrial area, an agricultural area.
There were no minutes taken at the Constitutional Convention that were at least made public for another 40 years. James Madison kept his own notes of the Constitution, and they have become really the primary document that we use to see what was actually said. And one thing that Madison points out is that very quickly it became clear to the delegates that the major division in the convention was between the slaveholding southern states and the northern states that were free. And much of the attention from that point on at the convention was focused on working out a compromise that would allow the North and the South to form a single union and work together, because the South was very reluctant to enter into a compact with the North because they were afraid Northerners wanted to eliminate slavery. By 1784, New England had already ended slavery, and a movement to get rid of it in the middle states, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, was afoot. South was frightened by this fact.
Even though New England chose to end slavery in many jurisdictions, the concept of superiority that flowed from the Puritan interpretation of the Bible still remained. You agree?
Yeah, oh, of course. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the point of our book ultimately is that concept of superiority still exists throughout most of the white community in America today.
Well, let's move forward to today and discuss how that concept is seen and applied. Seen from you, a white professor, and seen from a black person.
Well, one of the very interesting things we've found is that we originally, when we wrote the book, we intended it for white people. I mean, that's what we really thought our audience, that our audience would be primarily whites. And what we hoped to do was awaken whites to our own history and suggest that the white community continues to have a responsibility in relation to blacks, in relation to the way in which they've been disadvantaged in this society, and should consider doing something about it. What we found among whites is most of them really don't want to hear that message. Most of them resist it pretty strongly. Most African Americans, on the other hand, like the book, and what they say, in effect, is that it lays out a history of what they understand viscerally in their own experience, that whites still consider blacks inferior and do very little to give them equality in this society.
Notwithstanding the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement 100 years later?
Notwithstanding those things. As a matter of fact, what we say is that there have been three great moments in American history when blacks made great surges, great advancement. The first was after the Revolutionary War, second was after the Civil War, and the third was associated with the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s. After the Revolutionary War, what happened was there were about 80 to 100,000 free blacks suddenly created because they were men who had fought with the Continental Army. The prize they had been given for fighting against the British was their freedom. And so you suddenly had this large number of free blacks all over American society. The natural thing to think would be that, well, they were free, and there's a paradigm that says you are free or you are slave, and so these men then, because they were free, would have equal rights with white citizens. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. What they quickly found is they were treated not like white citizens, but as a new class, really, throughout then the early 18th century to the middle of the 18th century. Blacks, for example, could not get passports in this country. They could not travel abroad unless they had recommendation of a white person in power that would help them get an American passport. They were not allowed to work in many civil service positions, for example. They were denied the opportunity to work in postal jobs as postal carriers because it was feared by Southerners that they would carry messages of abolition into the South, and they didn't want that to happen. By the 1740s, a man named Hugh Laguerre, who was the Attorney General of the United States, dealt with this situation in a case that involved the homesteading rights in the territories, that there was a question of whether blacks should be given free land as whites were given in the territories. Aliens were excluded from this right. They had no right to free land in the territories, but whites did. What Laguerre finally said was that blacks were not aliens. They had been here for a long time, and so they did have homesteading rights. But in order to give them the homesteading rights, he didn't say they had the same rights as white citizens. What he said was they were a third category, and he called that category denizens. They were denizens of the land, meaning they had inhabited here for a long period of time, but they were not citizens. And that, indeed, was pretty much the judgment that stood up until the time of Dred Scott. And Dred Scott said the same thing, that blacks had no legal rights in U.S. courts because they were not citizens. Point being, really, there was this great surge after the Civil War in which a number of blacks were freed. They were not given the rights of white citizens. They were not free men in this country. There were laws that limited them in every direction in which they turned.
Well, let's move to the present time, 2005.
African Americans have made progress. In too many cases, though, it's reflected by the progress of a small group of people who have been concentrated in entertainment and athletics. Those African Americans certainly have done well. But what we're concerned about is the failure of the white community to address the issue of the bulk of African Americans, particularly those who are stuck in ghetto situations. So what you have to remember when you think about African Americans is that of all the different groups that have come to the United States one way or another, all of the other groups have come with a sense of hope and a sense that they could better themselves economically and that they could make a better life for themselves. Blacks, on the other hand, came here in chains without hope, and at every point at which they've seemed to have a moment of hope, those three instances that we were talking about a moment ago, it's taken away by the white community very quickly. That hope is taken from them, and they're stuck with the same situation. And what this country, we think of a place like South Africa, had a formal reconciliation process that it put in place. The U.S., we had a reconciliation process after the Civil War, but it was reconciliation between Southern and Northern whites, ultimately, and we never really created a similar reconciliation with blacks. Blacks have always asked for three things at each of these three moments in history, and those are education, land, and the right to vote. Again and again, they've simply been denied those things, and though I doubt if most people realize it, but in this country currently, there's something like 7 million African-American children living in extreme poverty. That means not poverty, not that you're poor, but it means that a family of three has less than $7,000 a year to live on. It's simply a travesty that we allow citizens of our country, people who are protected or supposedly protected by a constitution that guarantees equal rights to all citizens, that we allow people to be living in a situation like that.
How do you see the change being fomented?
I would hope ultimately the nation as a country, as a government, would take seriously its obligation to provide equality to all its citizens.
How would you articulate the way that could be done?
What I think has to be done, really, is returned something like the 1960s and a government program that was akin to the movement created then, and with the things that were put in place by the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and by the Voter Registration Act the following year. In 64, at Howard University, Lyndon Johnson spoke, and he said that if you take a man to the start of a race who's been in chains for 200 years, and you remove the chains, and then you say to him, well, now you're able to compete equally with everyone else. Johnson said, you're lying to him if you believe that man is capable of competing with everyone else in that condition. And what you have to provide, in effect, was compensatory programs for a period of time to allow him to reach a degree of equality. Then you have a society in which equality prevails. And what Johnson said following that was, what it's going to take for this to happen is willing hearts on the part of whites in this country. And it seems to me what we haven't had are those willing hearts.
So you're saying that almost two generations later, it's time for the hearts to be willing?
Well, I'm saying that we have to create a situation in whites in which whites understand their responsibility. Naive people that we were, we hope that a book like ours, if the white community would read the book, they'd be more likely to take up a responsibility which we believe is firmly theirs. I mean, this country, we talk so much about responsibility that we simply, you know, rely on those characteristics which we regard as American and the best examples of what our society can do, and assume our responsibility and do for the other citizens in this society what we expect for ourselves.
Frances Adams, co-author with Professor Barry Sanders of Alienable Rights, The Exclusion of African Americans in a White Man's Land, 1619 to 2000. I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious and ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
There's a book that I'm just reading that I'm very excited about called Collapses by Jared Diamond. And it's a book about what brings societies down. You know, what is it that causes societies to fail? What Diamond says, in effect, it isn't natural disasters. It isn't things like tsunamis and volcanic explosions. It's the ideas that a society holds, the power with which they grasp onto those ideas. And he talks about places like Easter Island, and particularly about a group of Norse pioneers who went to Greenland centuries ago and created a society there that lasted for 400 or 500 years. And it was a society built around things like beef and milk products. And what Diamond points out is that after about 400 years, their livestock denuded the land of all the grazable grass. Their animals began to starve to death. Finally, they were down to eating the young calves that they normally would create their new herd from, because they simply were starving to death. And then finally, the society disappeared. And the point that was so important to me was, Diamond said they were surrounded by an ocean of fish, and yet the places they've excavated there, they find no fishbone. They never turned to this other supply of food because they were so oriented toward their cultural belief in a kind of society that lived off land animals that they allowed the society to die out, not intentionally, but the society died out because they stayed with what they knew. And I mean, I think this is a wonderful insight into the way societies falter, and in fact, one that perhaps has some application to our current America.
Francis Adams, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Francis D. Adams is the co-author, along with Professor Barry Sanders, of Alienable Rights, The Exclusion of African Americans in a White Man's Land, 1619 to 2000. The book he recommends is Collapse by Jared Diamond.
There are over 630 archive editions on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're all free to listen and download and share anytime, anywhere, as my gift to you. Our programs are published weekly, normally on Tuesday evening. Your comments, ideas, and suggestions are always appreciated, and we do enjoy hearing from you. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org. Postal mail is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.